represents Forestman.
David Gordon representing the BLM.
And I guess at this time,
we have a tribal member that's on our RAC that's always a permanent member. They're not able, because of some changes that have taken place, they were unable to have somebody represented here today, tonight.
At this time, we'll do the approval of the agenda and the minutes. If everybody's gone over them, we'll take a motion.
I move to accept the agenda as presented.
Do I get a second?
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded that we accept the agenda, and it passes, so we'll move to board with the Wildlife Board meeting update.
We haven't had a Wildlife Board meeting for quite some time. The last board meeting, they passed everything that our RAC presented. So there's not much to go with there.
Well, that was short.
Yes. We'll have a regional update next. That'll be a little longer.
Well, let's move to the regional update.
Okay. In light of the long agenda, I'll go through this as quickly as I possibly can. For the RAC members, you'll see in front of you a proposal dealing with bats. And I was able to meet with these individuals before this meeting and talk with them a little bit. They had received some erroneous information and had come out to address fisheries, which will be addressed next RAC meeting. And so I have their proposal, and I guess you have their proposal as well in front of you. You can take that back and read it if you'd like. And then I'm going to deal with my aquatics manager and with the folks in Salt Lake on this and talk to them about it. And then we'll be in touch with Mr. Sackett during the month. So that deals with that little tidbit there. The next thing, our law enforcement, Tori, most of you know Tori, he's taken a one-year position in Salt Lake. So we're in a little bit of flux in our law enforcement right now. Sean Davis has moved in to take over the lieutenant's position. And I think we made the move of Randy moving in into the new sergeant position. And most of you know Randy. I'll just let you know that he is one of our new sergeants. In our habitat section, they've just finished up on some major fencing projects in Willow Creek. They've been spending a lot of time on PJ removal and lop and scatters in the Buck Cliffs. Along with the other biologists from the sections, they're all helping each other out on those. We're also, we sent a couple of biologists to some advanced training on restoration and ecology and habitat enhancement over the last few months. In our wildlife section, they're starting the pronghorn surveys this month, August? They've started their pronghorn surveys. And we'll be also starting our black-footed ferret surveys. Our sensitive species crew, they've been working on surveying for bats, yellow-billed cuckoos. And that's not them. That's the actual bird. And they've also surveying for our prairie dog. It's a disease study. Our aquatics folks, they just finished up their early season trend netting surveys, and now they're moving into the high Uintas and working on Colorado cutthroat and amphibian surveys. Along with outreach and law enforcement, they help the scouts up there during their summer camps catch fish, and that was very good. It's always good to be able to get up there and help them help the kids catch fish. It's a good experience for them. They've also started preparations for our second treatment of the Sheep Creek. And they've gone up and they've surveyed the lakes and streams up there that we treated last year. And by the most part, the treatment was a success, but there are just a few fish in some of the lower areas. And we always, when we do these treatments, in particular of these places that have a lot of little lakes and streams, we have to do it 2 years in a row and make sure that we get a kill. And then they'll be put stocking those with Colorado cuts this next year. Our outreach, they held our annual osprey watch, and as a wildlife watching event, and apparently it rained pretty good, and almost got rained out. But Ron, as you can see, he's pretty stout, and he stuck it out, and they got that done. Other than that, that's about all that we've got going. Everybody seems to be pretty busy. I don't see them very often, and so that means they're busy, and that's good. So that's our regional update. I tried to make it as short and sweet as possible in light of the agenda, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Boyd. Any questions from the RAC members? Nobody wants to put him on the spot? Thanks, Boyd. With that, then we'll move to our turkey depredation with Jason Robinson. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you.
Dustin, would you reach behind you and lower the lights on this section over here, please? Very good, thank you.
Okay, I think we're all set. I'm Jason Robinson, I'm the Upland Game Coordinator out of the Salt Lake City office. I'm going to give an informational item on wild turkeys. So what we'll be covering tonight is information on House Bill 342 that was passed this last session, DWR's response and plan of action to that bill, and then talk about trapping and transplanting and the potential use of a depredation hunt for nuisance birds. So House Bill 342, Wild Turkey Management, chief sponsor was Representative Minlove, and basically this bill requires the DWR to investigate and mitigate material damage to private property by wild turkeys. If a private landowner is having material damage to their property, they can notify the Utah Division of Wildlife, and the Division of Wildlife will respond to that within 72 hours. We have a variety of different options available for us to try and deal with those nuisance turkeys, including hazing, transplants, and potential use of a depredation hunt. This bill still gives rulemaking authority to the Wildlife Board related to private property damage caused by wild turkeys. It also allows the Wildlife Board to establish two general season turkey hunts per year, an over-the-counter spring hunt that we already currently have, and then the use of a fall hunt to help alleviate some of the damages caused by wild turkeys. In response to this bill, DWR will be hiring a part-time wild turkey specialist. They will have three major tasks. The first is to assist the Upland Game Coordinator, myself, with wild turkey management plan update. The second is to assist regions with wild turkey complaints. And the third is to help coordinate out-of-state turkey transplants. That would be both in-state and out-of-state transplants, depending on the subspecies of turkey. As an example, we get Merriam turkeys from South Dakota to put in high elevation areas where there's a very low likelihood that we'll have interaction or problems with those turkeys. So DWR's plan of action for a turkey complaint, respond to the complaint within 72 hours. evaluate the best course of action, depending on the property, land ownership, that kind of thing. Again, we have several options for dealing with those turkeys, including hazing, off-site feeding, capture and transplant those turkeys, and a hunt. Our primary tool is to capture and transplant those turkeys to approved sites. And if that doesn't work, we will offer a turkey depredation hunt. A turkey transplant list is required by code for wild turkeys. The current list for approved transplant sites was developed at the regional level and was approved by the RAC and board for 5 years. It covers 2010 to 2014. There was 254 approved sites on that transplant list, and we still have approved sites in all five DWR regions. So if we need to do a depredation hunt, just going into a little more detail here. We will implement a depredation hunt if capture and transplant is not working or is not practical. These hunts will be in limited areas and limited numbers. The regions will be determining when, where, and how many turkeys to harvest. We will be implementing this under existing DWR authority. That's why it's an informational item tonight. Basically, they'll be structured after the big game depredation hunts. If a person's interested in applying for these depredation hunts, they can apply online at the web page there on the DWR webpage, depredation. Basically, once we have a pool of people that have applied, there'll be a random draw to select the hunters to hunt those areas. Again, these hunts are short notice, small areas, few hunters. The main objective of these depredation hunts is to deal with these nuisance turkeys. A person that's successful in the random draw can use their unfilled 2013 turkey permit or purchase a permit once they're selected in the draw. A person is not eligible if they harvested a turkey in the 2013 season. Thank you.
Any questions from any of the RAC members?
That was good. How do you think the birds are holding up on the over-the-counter sales? It appears to me I've been seeing a few less birds. What's your thoughts?
Looking at the statewide data, they're doing actually quite well. We had a couple of rough years, but this last year's data, we actually harvested more turkeys than we have in the past several years. Hunter success rates are higher this year. So I think they're doing well. I think, you know, hunting them a little bit harder has changed their behavior a little bit. They're smarter birds. But I think the populations are doing well.
Jason, yeah. Is there one region that's this is more of a problem than others, or is this?
Yeah, there's probably.
Can you share with us some of those areas?
The northern region, specifically Cache County, has had some issues that they're dealing with. We captured quite a few turkeys out of there last year. But offering this depredation hunt will just give them another tool in the toolbox. Just to give you an example, we took over 370 turkeys out of the northern region last year, moved them to other places in the state where they might cause nuisance. The other regions, not so much of an issue, but we wanted to give options for folks to move in the future.
What is the transplant success rate for these turkeys?
Very high. You know, pretty much every turkey in the state of Utah was transplanted. And so if you look back, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there was not nearly the turkeys there are now.
I'm just wondering what the success rate is for the turkey themselves, the survival rate following transplantation.
We don't have specific numbers on individual success rates, but looking at anecdotally, it's quite high.
Any other questions? Any other RAC members? Any questions from our public? Okay, well, thank you, Jason. This is just information, no action, so appreciate the information.
Thank you.
Now we'll move on to the waterfowl guidebook and rule R65709. Larry?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Blair Stream. I'm the waterfowl coordinator, and tonight I'll be presenting the 2013-2014 waterfowl hunt recommendations. So the way our waterfowl regulations are put together each year, we base this on two important surveys. The first one of those is a habitat survey, which is the number of ponds that are all across Prairie Canada and Prairie United States, as well as other parts of the country. It gives us an idea of what breeding habitat conditions are like for waterfowl for that given year. The other data that we look at is our waterfowl breeding population index. This is a count of the number of breeding pairs that we have in these high breeding areas in the prairies. This gives us an idea of what our fall flight will be each year. So just quickly summarize this data for you. Overall conditions have been really favorable for waterfowl this year. Water in across the prairies is up from what it was last year and still remains above its long-term average. So overall, we have really good conditions. As far as the population response to those, our geese populations in the state continue to do excellent. They're up from where they were last year, and across the flyway continue to do really well. Our swans are a similar story. Lots of swans in all of our counts and continue to do great. Our duck populations, overall, it's a similar picture to what we saw last year. The one real key species to highlight here is the lesser scop. They decreased significantly from where they were last year and still continue to remain below their long-term average. So for our season lengths this year, it's based upon really what our mallard populations are doing in the western part of this continent. And so overall, they continue to do really well. And as a result, we get a liberal package this year. So we get the maximum season length, which is 107 days, as well as the maximum bat, which is 7 birds per day. There are several species there, though, that do have species-specific limitations to them. The first one of those being the pintail. They'll have the full season length, but a bag of two. Canvasback will have the full season length as well, and a bag of two. And that's actually an increase of one more bird from where it was last year. Lesser scop, as I said, declined this year. And so as a result, they have a shorter season, which will be 86 days, and a bag of three. Redheads will have a bag of two, and wood ducks will have a bag of two. So to quickly go over our season frameworks, the season for ducks, mergansers, coots, snipe, and falconry will be October 5th till January 18th. And that reduced season for scop will be from October 5th till December 28th. The falling bag limits will, as you see here, nothing really has changed much except for that lesser scop limit. We have done a couple changes to our dark goose zones this year in a response to address some issues that we have along the Wasatch Front and some of the more urban areas of the state. We've created a new zone. In doing that, we modified our northern zone to be just the eastern portion of Box Elder County. That season will run from October 5th till January 18th. The urban zone, which is the new zone, will be Salt Lake, Davis, Utah, Weber, and Washington counties. And that will run from October 5th till 17th, have a break, and then continue until February 2nd. That'll allow us to harvest more geese in those urban areas. The rest of the state will have a season date that will start on October 5th and until the 17th of October, and then resuming on the 26th and until January 26th. And our bag will be three per day and nine in possession. For light goose seasons, they remain unchanged, really, for the most part. The changes that we have done this year, we have been able to increase the bag on light geese, and so that will be 20 per day and 16 possession. We also, in order to achieve a more liberal harvest on snow geese and Ross geese, we've been able to implement the use of electronic collars as well as unplugged shotguns. That will only be for portions of the waterfowl season when there's no other species being hunted. And so that will only occur during those March and February and March portions of the light goose season. For our swans, be the same as last year. The season runs from October 5th till December 8th. Be only in the Great Salt Lake Hunt Area and have 2,000 permits. And our youth day, our recommendation for that this year will be on September 28th, which will be 1 week before the general duck opener. There are two specific regulations that could affect some of the WMAs. In an effort to remove Phragmites from some of our waterfowl management areas, primarily along the Great Salt Lake, there may be some burns that would temporarily close those areas. We also have Ogden Bay along the Great Salt Lake, and they'll have some temporary closures due to some maintenance to replace some culverts that were damaged in a flood of 2011. Two other recommendations. We're recommending that Clear Lake Waterfowl Management Area go to a motorist-only unit. This is in response to a lack of water in that area, and so we have really shallow water conditions. In the northern region, we're switching our mud, motor, and motorless units just to accommodate more hunters, because that the unit we're changing is a lot bigger, and so it'll allow more people to go out and hunt and access that with their mud motors. Lastly, there's an action item that was given by the board last year to address additional hunting opportunities in the state for swans. Some background on this. It was very controversial when we established our swan hunts, and so as a result, there were a series of lawsuits. And eventually, what we were confined to was by an environmental assessment in 2003, which limited us to only being able to hunt around the Great Salt Lake and have 2,000 permits per year. It also required that we put hunters through a swan orientation class, that they measured their bills with their swans if they were to harvest, and there were some consequences if they weren't reporting their swans or taking that swan orientation course. So in looking at additional opportunities in the state, at this time we aren't able to offer any until we can actually increase the trumpeter swan population in the Pacific Flyway. As of right now, that population is fairly stagnant. It's not really increasing or decreasing. And so the possibility of having any hunt in the future is probably very slim. So our recommendation right now would just be to have no changes this time. And that concludes regulations. Thank you.
Betty and Blair? Yep. Appreciate that. Any comments or any questions from the RAC board? Mr. Bagg?
I'm new, so I don't understand. But why is the sandhill crane not addressed as a hunt?
That's a good question. We actually do that hunt recommendation in our May meeting. It comes through with the upland game hunting recommendations. It's because we need to have the dates published in the federal registrar before the hunt occurs. And so typically they, like the waterfowl regulations, aren't published until about the 20th or so of September. So we need to do that earlier in order for them to be published before that hunt starts in the 1st of September.
We did that at our last meeting, Joe.
Okay.
And they said they was going to help us out with the federal government best they could, so we appreciate that. And we got the three seasons.
Yep.
That was a good deal for us. And we went back on my Christmas list after that. So.
Thank you.
Any questions from the public? And I don't see any comment cards, so at this time we'll take a proposal to accept it.
I'll make a proposal to accept it as presented.
Any comments? Any more comments? I'll, at this time, accept the nominee or proposal to accept the Fish and Games proposal.
I'll make the motion.
I'll make
the motion.
Yeah.
And I'll second it.
Okay. It's been proposed. The motion's been made, seconded to accept the DWR's waterfowl guidebook. Can we have a vote at this time?
I'll approve it.
Yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passed. Okay, at this time we'll move on to the military installation permit program. Can you give them the proposal?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, RAC members, members of the public. I'm Kenny Johnson, Admin Services in Salt Lake City, and I'll be presenting a really quick rule that we're kind of excited about. It's a military installation permit program that will allow some access to property that we've not historically had any access to for hunting. So let's just jump right into it. The purpose of the rule just sets the standard, like I said, to provide some opportunity to hunt on some big tracts of lands that have typically been closed for us. And really for two groups of people, for military personnel and for members of the public. So we like that. Some of the basics, we're really talking about three major players at this point: Camp Williams, Hill Air Force Base, and Dugway. Any military installation with 10,000 contiguous acres could approach us with a program to allow some hunting. The three main species we're talking about: deer, elk, and pronghorn, but we're going to keep that open-ended to any big game hunting opportunity. Essentially what happens, and I'll try to explain this succinctly and not spend a lot of time on it, but we want the base commander, so the person in charge of the military property, to approach us with kind of a plan to be able to hunt on that property. And so the first thing we'll address here is the permits. He's going to request permits from the Wildlife Board by September 1st, and then when the Wildlife Board approves those will become available the following year. The Wildlife Board will kind of make that approval based on the number around population trend, size, and the distribution of the animals on that property. One permit for sure. So even if they only proposed a handful of permits, one permit for sure would go to the general public. If they go with more than that, if they request more than that, up to 20% would be made available to the general public through our current Bucks and Bulls big game draw that happens roughly February every year. The season hunt dates would happen from September 1st to October 31st. So that's kind of the permit side. On the military side, we would actually, instead of just giving them permits, the base commander would request the number of permits, but then we would approve a process that he would fairly and equitably distribute those to the military. And so it would actually be in a voucher form, which means it can be redeemed at some point for a permit in the future. And that second bullet's kind of key. We don't want these vouchers to be able to be donated, auctioned, traded, sold, or put on eBay or anywhere weird like that. We want it to meet the intent, which is to allow military personnel to hunt and some public to hunt. So there will be, we'll watch that really close to make sure that is not happening. And again, that's just the permits then for the public go through our draw process. And then the military installation commander, I guess the main points here, he's kind of in charge of what happens out there on the base in regards to hunting. And so he's going to identify up front what weapons they'll allow, and those weapons will have to conform to the rules and regulations that we already published for taking big game. And then he's going to have to be kind of coordinating in that initial agreement, when the season dates are, what the boundaries are, weapon choices. And that's a lot of that's administrative for us to be able to prepare the application for the public so they know what to apply for when they go into the computer system and apply. So this will be a lot like what we're already used to in that respect. Again, it just opens some access to places we typically haven't had. And, it allows them another tool to kind of manage these populations of wildlife on their property. So, and again, up to 20% go to the general public. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenny. At this time, we'll take any questions from the rack.
Yeah, I have one.
Ahead,
Kenny, in the initial discussion of this, there was talk about using some of these for disabled veterans. Mm-hmm. Has that been part of the discussion, or is that kind of falling by the way, or where are we at on that?
No, I think it's still part of what they're going to consider, and I think where we would discuss that more is in that initial memorandum of understanding.
Okay.
When they're going to distribute those permits, they could tell us that they planned on offering some of those to disabled veterans for sure.
I just think that's something we ought to pursue and continue to push for a little bit.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Thank you. Any other comments from the RAC members?
I have a question. How much interest has been shown by the military and the general public as far as opportunity to hunt on the military?
That's a fair question. The military, we've talked with the commander at Hill Air Force Base and some of the other ones, but they've shown the most interest to this point. And so I think they're kind of excited and looking forward to it. the public? Boyd?
I was just signaling to him that when you're done, I would have something to say.
If you let me. And, you know, the public, we haven't really gauged it. This is relatively new, so I don't think they know about it, but I know they salivate when they drive past Camp Williams and some of those places, so.
Yeah.
Any other questions from REC members?
Yeah, I have one. So Kenny, these base commanders, these military base commanders, do they have trained staff in biology or, you know, big game, hunting management? Do they have staff like that, or will this be just a really close relationship between DWR and the base commander, for example, or do they have trained staff?
These places have trained staff, so it will be a joint effort, obviously, sure, with both, but they do have trained staff to kind of monitor populations and stuff already.
Any other questions? Any questions from the public? Any comments from the REC members? And I have no comment cards from the public, so at this time, without getting flustered, I'll entertain a motion.
Boy.
It's okay. He said if he wanted, so I was just folding my arms and waiting my turn.
Never asked me to do this again, will you?
No. When I recently did a stint in Salt Lake, and Joe asked if there was interest in this, and I actually began to work with Dugway Proving Grounds for pronghorn, and there was a whole lot of interest generated for the Dugway Proving Grounds and for military personnel or retired military personnel and those kinds of things. So there is a lot of interest. There is a lot of land out there that has been off limits for the public, and we felt like this was an excellent, excellent opportunity to get the public additional opportunities. So.
Thanks, Wade. So at this time, I'll entertain a motion to accept the DWR's proposal.
Thanks, Chairman.
Ben, move. Do I get a second?
I'll make a motion. let's accept DWR's proposal as presented.
A second motion.
Been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passed. Thanks, sir.
Thank you. And I think I'm on deck again, so I'm going to stay right here.
All right. She's all yours.
John's timing me out there. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll switch gears and move into some proposed fee changes. And I think this group's probably familiar with the process. We don't have carte blanche to just change fees and that's that. We take it through this really regimented process, and it begins right here with our RACs. And everybody from the public can have input, and then they move to the Wildlife Board and they consider and approve. And the governor's office reviews the proposal and makes a recommendation to the legislature. And then our Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee approves, modifies, or rejects the proposal. And then any fees that become approved at that point get included in the annual appropriation bill and voted on by all the legislators. And then those fees take effect the following fiscal year, which in this case would be July 1st of 2014. Really quick overview of kind of the division funding. The division is largely self-funded, and a lot of our revenue, the majority of it, comes through the sale of hunting and fishing licenses. So you can kind of see the pie chart there. Restricted revenue is our biggie. That almost 50% comes from directly licenses, hunting and fishing licenses and permits. That 29%, the next biggest chunk there, are matched federal funds. It's almost 30% based on the number of people who hunt and fish in our state. The dedicated credits, that 12%, that's other special funding, a lot of conservation money, those kinds of things, is that size of pie. And only 9% of our operating budget comes from general funds. And so we're different from a lot of state agencies in that regard. We kind of have to be able to operate, you know, more like a business and watch market influences a little bit differently. Some of the immediate financial impacts, we've identified the need for $3.2 million in critical revenue. One thing worth mentioning, we haven't really significantly done anything with fees for anglers in 15 years. We'll look at a chart here in just a second that shows the history back to 98 or so. And of note also, our cost to do business just kind of continue to steadily increase and rise just like any business. And angler participation and combo purchasers have been relatively flat in recent years, and I'll show you a graph of that. This is just the last 5 years. So the top line, the red line, is our fishing sales in the last 5 years. You can kind of see they're flat a little bit to maybe trending down. Combo there in the middle, same kind of thing. Trend is just really flat, and hunting licenses at the bottom there. So with that boring graph of no real star performing license sales, and our costs continuing to increase, you can see that that's not a very sustainable trajectory. So that's why we're kind of coming out with this proposal at this point. Some of the specific things we need to address: aquatics. We want to enhance our warm water fish production, meet our increased hatchery costs and feed and utilities, liquid oxygen, those kinds of things. Enhance our popular urban or community fisheries program. That one's grown huge in the last little while. It's widely popular in the urban areas that have one of those. We want to enhance that for sure. We need to fill a key biologist position out this way, the Flaming Gorge Green River area. We're looking to replace some lost federal Department of Interior funding. We'd like to update to a new hydroacoustics trawler, and then address some increases in our cost to motor pool, and that's at $1.4 million. For terrestrial species, we want to replace some lost walk-in access funding, and then just address the urban wildlife conflict issues that are seeming to grow every year, and then some more motor pool there. And then personnel, this is kind of our labor benefits area. We've got some current and future employee benefits and some pay discrepancies we'd like to address as well. And this is obviously in conjunction with the process with the governor's office and the legislature. So what we think we'll see at the end of all of this, we kind of make projections based on current sales, and we try to predict how many people we might lose or gain. And we anticipate at the end of all this, this will get us close to that $3.2 million that we're looking for. And these will definitely help us meet those critical needs. Now, the approach we had, a lot of people think we might just broad brush this thing and bump up the fees on everybody, and that's that. We really actually worked a lot with our conservation partners, with the anglers group internally at the division. We wanted to analyze this and come up with an approach that helped us meet our needs, but maybe made more sense with the way licenses are sold and the way they work in Utah. So what you'll see here in the proposals, we're going to reduce fees for youth 14 to 18. We see those guys dropping off kind of in droves by the time they're 17 or 18. We'd like to keep their interest a little bit longer in fishing and hunting. We're going to eliminate the need for a two-pole permit by just including that in the season fishing and in the combo permit. So we think we're adding some value to the public there. Another thing, maybe some more flexibility at the point of sale with providing multiple year purchases. We always get hit up occasionally about that lifetime license, and boy, wouldn't it be nice if that came back. This is probably as close as we're going to get. So at point of sale, we want to offer multiple years of hunting, fishing, and combo licenses. So you'll see that here in a minute too. And then we wanted to keep a reduced fishing license for seniors. They're, you know, big mentors for our mission, and we are going to propose an increase to the 65 and over cohort, but we're still going to keep it discounted. And then we're going to ask for some introductions of combo and hunting licenses for senior discounts as well. And then we've done some things for disabled veterans recently. We offered a discount a couple of years ago. The legislature let us start that, and we waded into it kind of tentatively, not knowing the impact, and we gave them a $5 discount at 20% service-connected disability rating, or at 40% we started at. This year we reduced that to 20% to hopefully reach more disabled veterans, and we're going to propose a discount, a little bit heavier discount for those guys here. So I'll show you that one here in just a second, too. Just really quick slide. I won't dwell on this one, but the point of this one is red is bad and blue is good. If you look down that left-hand column, that 20 to 80, that's the age participation of people who are buying that flavor of license. So we've got resident, non-resident, and then fishing, hunting, and combo for each category. So you can see, you know, pretty young in the fishing world, and then about 50, we start losing some anglers, and then magically, lo and behold, at 65, we get a bunch of them back. I can't imagine that $5 was all the incentive, but it looks like it had an impact there. And so where we get to, you know, the mid-late 50s in hunting and combo, and those columns start to turn solid red, that's a concern for us. And so we're hoping to offer something to the seniors to keep them engaged and keep them providing mentor opportunities for new hunters and fishermen. And then non-resident, I left that on there. It's kind of boring. They distribute fairly evenly. There's not a lot of youth and then not a lot of seniors. The ones coming to Utah seem to be that 40 to 50, 55 range. So that is that one. The feed history really quick. You can kind of just see where we've been since 1998. We've essentially increased fishing $2. Combo's about where we were in 98. In the middle there, we got up to 34. We made some strategic adjustments to have people have a license, require a license to apply for or obtain big game permits. So we've done some things to help along the way, and this just kind of indicates that history. And we haven't really done a whole lot over that time. So let's just jump into these. These next three are kind of the critical slides here, and I'll just hit them one at a time. If there's a fee under current, that means it is an existing license today, and then we're going to propose a new fee on that. If there's no fee there, it's a brand new license that we're going to offer. So let's just start right at the top. Resident 365, 18 and over, currently is $26. We're going to propose that become $34. We're going to offer that multiple year version of that at a dollar discount per year, at $33 a year. And then resident youth, 365 days, the 14 to 17 year olds we kind of talked about. Currently they're paying full retail, 26, and we'd like to offer youth and families a break at $16 there. The resident one day, any age, is currently $8. We're going to propose that go away, and right below that we're going to replace it with a little bit longer minimum purchase of 3 days at $16 for those 3 days. The resident 7 days, $16 currently. We want to bump that up to $20. Resident 365 for senior 65 and over, 21 currently. We propose that go to $25. Veterans with disabilities, again, there's the $21 fee, and we're going to propose that go to $12. And then the tuple, that's currently $15, and again, that one's going to dissolve and just become part of the season license, so that will be zero. Resident fishing set line, we don't sell very many of those, but it's $15. We want to propose that go to $20. And then I kind of blocked those out a little bit in resident and non-resident. So now we'll hit the non-resident stuff in the gray box. Non-resident full season is $70. We want to bump that to $75. A multi-year version of that right below there. And then non-resident youth, we want to see if we can get more non-resident youth fishing over here and introduce them to Utah, and we're going to propose that be $25. And then the same thing with non-resident one day. That's currently $12. We're going to propose that go away and become a 3 day, so that next line down, currently $0. We're going to propose that be $24 and be a 3 day purchase. And then their 7 day for non-residents is currently $32. We're going to propose that be $40. And then the tuple, same thing, that'll be dissolved and become part of the fishing and combo, and then the set line for or non-resident, same thing, $15 to $20. Some smaller list here on the hunting side of things. Currently, nothing for youth. That's full retail. So 14 to 17 for a full 365 days of hunting. We want to propose that be $16. This 365 day, 18 and over. Currently $26. We're proposing that be $34. And then the multi-year version of that at 33 a year. And then resident 65 and over, this one doesn't exist currently, but we want to offer them a little bit of a discount for that, some incentive, and that'll be $25. And then the resident 365-day hunter ed hunting, I'll take a minute just to explain how that one works, and most of us in this room probably know, but when you sign up for hunter safety right now, you pay $10. At the end of your successful completion, your hunter ed instructor signs it, puts a little sticker on there, and it becomes a 365-day hunting license, which is awesome. We think that's great. We think it was smart. But what we want to do is, this looks kind of weird because it's going from $10 to $0, but what you'll see in the combination world, we want to propose that the hunting license become a combination for people signing up for hunter ed. So we want to introduce them to maybe entice them to fish instead of just get that hunting opportunity. So you'll see that on the next slide again. I'll try not to talk as long about it when we get over there. And then non-resident youth, 14 to 17, again, $25. Non-resident 18 and over is currently 65. We're proposing no change to that. One of the things I think the division's done a great job of in recent years is walking that fine line with keeping people interested in applying for our big game permits and not pricing them out of the market. And if you look at the trends in the West, a lot of other states see their applications, you know, really, really tapering off. And Utah, we've been able to keep those guys interested and keep them around. So we're going to propose no change for that. Resident multi-year, up to five with that, 64, so a dollar discount there. Non-residents, the same thing with the hunter ed hunting license. And we'll address that one here in the combo slide. And then non-resident 3-day, it's currently 25. We're going to propose that go to 35. And then that bottom one, that sportsman's elk premium, that means two a year. There's not very many of these. It's essentially just out of the gate. It was mismarked. We have limited entry elk fees, and we have premium limited entry elk fees. This is the premium. This is the one everybody kind of considers the governor's tag. And so we're just going to bump that up to the premium fee, that 508. And again, only two of those, so no real significant impact anywhere, but it makes it fair. Combination, we'll just hammer through these. Resident 365 to 18 and over, $30 currently. We're going to propose that become 38, and then the multi-year version of that at 37. Youth combination doesn't exist currently. We want to offer 14 to 17 year olds a $20 combo. 65 and over combination doesn't exist currently. We want to offer that at $29. And then there's the 365-day hunter ed completion combination license. And we do want to increase it. It was $10 on the previous slide. We're going to bump it up $2 and give them the fishing privilege as well, is our proposal. Non-resident 18 and over, 365. That one's 80 currently. We're going to propose that go to 85. And then non-resident hunter ed completion, same thing, the $12. Multi-year of the combo at 84 a year. And then non-resident youth combo at 29. So we got through the heavy three slides. We got a couple more miscellaneous ones, so we're almost there. We're getting there. We just wanted to give you guys an idea of what we compare, kind of where we are with the Western states. So if you look at the categories, hunting, fishing, and combo, resident price on the left, non-resident price on the right. And Utah is probably a little bit unique in that, in some of this area as well. A lot of the surrounding states rely really heavily on non-residents for revenue. In Utah, we aren't there. So we think we're pretty fair in comparison across the board to what everybody else is doing. So that is that slide. And then just a couple of really quick comparisons. You know, when you amortize a fishing license or a combo license on a daily percentage, I think it's about a dime, maybe a little bit less than that, about 10 cents a day. So just in comparison to other recreation, a Utah ski day, $75 a whack. An outdoor concert, $44. I learned if I would have made this PowerPoint A couple days later, I learned that an indoor concert for a pretty popular boy band is a lot more than that, because I have a 16-year-old daughter. I didn't include it on there. Jazz game, run you about $44. Average round of golf, depending on how fancy the course is, we found $52. And then some of the Salt Lake Valley team sport things to sign up for a month or two, for basketball or soccer or baseball, about $110. Miscellaneous range fees. What we're proposing here, a couple years ago, this is essentially Lee K and our Cache Valley shooting range up in Logan. We just wanted to propose some price ranges here for shotgun shooting, for archery rifle and handgun shooting, for punch passes, that gives us a little bit more market flexibility. And so we don't, when we need to bump, you know, a youth handgun admission from $2 to $2.50, we don't have to come back through the whole entire process. So we're hoping to get just some ranges approved that'll give us some flexibility and let us address some of the local community needs for both of those shooting centers. And so that's what we're proposing there. Those are all currently, the top one, the punch pass for shotgun is $45 for 10 rounds. We just want to put a range on that. And that's kind of what that slide is indicating there. And then now we're really getting close to the bottom. The miscellaneous real estate fees. These are kind of a lot of paperwork for doing various things. And I honestly don't understand a lot of these to too deep a level. But lease applications, right-of-way easement applications, amendments, those kinds of things. We haven't touched this part of the fee schedule for over 15 years as well. And so we just want to get to where the existing market kind of is right now. And these are kind of based on what maybe CITLA does and those kinds of things. So these get us in line with what's currently happening out there in the market. So you can see a couple of those applications, 50 to 250. Easement application, 50 to 750. Amendments, 25 to 400. Right-of-way, right-of-entries, 25 to 50. Some of the assignments, special use, those kinds of things. Those are a little bit over the board right now. We're just going to propose that be standard at 250. Easements, oil, gas, pipelines, 250. And then some of the pipeline dimensions and at the bottom there, just a few dollar increase on some of those to keep us in line with what the market's doing. So not a real significant source of anything. It just gets us in step with what's out there. So just to summarize, our costs continue to increase. And to kind of help us meet that mission in the immediate future, we just need to make some adjustments to market influences. We think this proposal helps us do that, but still makes it smarter for the public. It gives them value. It adds. It takes some of the burden off of families. And so we're excited about that, and it still helps, you know, veterans and seniors as well. And we have no other fees proposed at this time. So that is all.
Thank you, Kenny. Any questions from the RAC members? Any questions from the public?
I'm just wondering how there's not any five-day barrier fever pursuit on them cars. Jared Workman.
It's a good question, Jared. We aren't proposing to touch those right now.
Okay, I'm not complaining about the five-day or anything. I just wanted to know they do the bottom and stuff like that.
For just some statistics?
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of those with me tonight, but I can get them for you if you want to come touch base with me when I get back to the office.
All right. Thanks.
Any other questions? Any comments from the RAC members?
Just a couple.
John?
Just a couple. I think the discussion to start looking at the fee increase and the fee changes is appropriate, and it's appropriate every year. For me to support this overall recommendation, I'm not sure that I can do that tonight, because I'd like to look at a few of the details here a little bit more. With my background and a little understanding, I understand that there are several areas in DWR that are supporting themselves quite well, and several areas that are falling deficient and short and needing a little support. One of them, depredation and agricultural problems, trying to help offset some of those costs of damage that are done. We do have a little bit of a reserve in the state, in the Fish and Game Fund. I do understand that we have started to eat into that the last year or two. And so the time to start discussing this is now, because it's a slow process to get this all the way through and get it through our body, which is fairly tough to do sometimes. But I'm probably not going to be able to support the overall recommendation tonight. There are some areas here that I certainly support, some areas that I want to take a little closer look at, and kind of balance all of that. And then I would like to talk to some of my constituents and see what their feeling is on some of this a little bit more before I can just blanket support this tonight. So just so you know where I'm coming from.
Yes. Any other comments?
I can make a little bit of a comment to that, John, it might help a little bit. With the change in administration, there are some new tools, or old tools have been reinstated to help with depredation, mm-hmm. wherein those depredating animals are carrying their share of the costs that they're creating. And I'm really impressed with what's taking place so far this year.
Part of that, that's part of the reason I kind of am holding off to see how that kind of plays out and works out a little bit. Because that has been one of our costly, that has been one of our big costs.
And you're right, Joe, they've been baby steps, but they're headed in the right direction. Slow steps and baby steps. Any other comment from any of the RAC members? I guess I'll entertain a motion on the action.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and make a motion to accept the division's proposal for the fee schedule change.
Do I get a second?
I'll second it.
Been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No.
You need a good count.
5-4.
5-4
against.
Okay.
No, you can't.
Only
try at a time. Only guy have tried.
It's 5-4.
Yeah.
5 years.
5-4 yeas. So motion passes.
Can you give me the
who
said yes?
He was.
You want to raise hands against Gil? Would that make
this side?
What you want?
This side of me, Gil.
The dark side.
Everybody on this side.
Well, it would be interesting to
see what they feel about it.
Thank you, Kenny. Well, now, okay. Thanks again, Kenny. Now we'll move to action number 9, rule amendments. Jordan Nelson, you got the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Sheriff. My name is Jordan Nielsen. I'm the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator. Tonight we're proposing two modifications to our Aquatic Invasive Species Interdiction Rule. We'll just dive right into this. The first one has to do with Lake Powell. In March of this year, we found adult and juvenile quagga mussels at Lake Powell.
That's
very true. That's very bad. In May, the Wildlife Board declared Lake Powell as an infested water body. As such, we need to define what Lake Powell is in our interdiction rule so that legally voters know where they can or can't go and where they have to be decontaminated. Lake Powell itself is fairly easy to define by its high water mark at 3,700 feet. However, its tributaries, where we have boat traffic in and out of the lake, are somewhat more difficult to define. I've worked with the BLM Escalante office and with the with our MOAP field office that spend a lot of time on these rivers to figure out where the point of no return is for boats coming down the rivers where they have to end up in the lake and as a result would have to decontaminate. So the first major tributary is the Colorado River. We've selected Spanish Bottom in Canyonlands National Park as the point of no return of going into the lake. Boats can, jet boats can run up the river from Lake Powell to Cataract Canyon, and they can't go any higher than that. Spanish Bottom is just above Cataract Canyon. Rafts coming down can turn around at Spanish Bottom and have a jet boat take them back upstream. So Spanish Bottom seems to be that cutoff point on the Colorado River. On Escalante River, the Coyote Creek confluence, or Coyote Gulch, is going to be our cutoff point. Once raptors pass that point, they have to go clear out Bullfrog, thus entering the lake and decontaminate their boats. There are a few brave souls that will pack up their rafts and backpack about 5 miles out at that point on the Escalante River. The Dirty Devil River, we're proposing the Highway 95 bridge near Hype as the cutoff point. And on the San Juan River, we're proposing Glen Hills Crossing near Pipe Farms. At the current lake level, if people pass that point, they have to go over a waterfall, and they would essentially be in Lake Powell. The second modification that we need to make to our rule is in regards to making our decontamination procedures more efficient for boaters that tend to boat on one water and only on one water. We have typically we find that there are large segments of our boating population that stick to one water most of the time. For example, on Sand Hollow, if we have a boater that goes there, pays their fee, enters the park, launches their boat, has a good time that day, pulls their boat out, wants to camp there and launch the next day, the way the rule is written, they would have to have their boat professionally decontaminated before they could launch again. The verbiage that we want to add to our rule modifies it so that they can launch their boat, have a good time, pull their boat out, clean and drain their boat, temporarily store it, and then subsequently launch the boat at the same location without having to go through the professional decontamination process. It essentially frees up a lot of our resources allows boaters to more easily access waters that they repeatedly visit. This slide just has some of the verbiage that we're going to use. That is in the memo that I've written to you guys that you, have, that you can review, so I don't need to go through all of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jordan. Any questions from the RAC members?
Hi there.
Yes, John.
How long do quagga mussel live on a boat once they're out of the water?
Once they're out of the water?
Uh-huh.
That depends on a lot of different conditions, mostly humidity and temperature. If boaters choose to self-decontaminate, we allow boaters to self-decontaminate in Utah. They can clean their boat, drain it of all the water. And during the summer months, at this time of year, they have to have that boat in a dry condition for 7 days. And that should kill all of the quagga mussels on it. In the shoulder seasons, spring and fall, 18 days. And in the winter, it's 30 days unless we get 3 days consecutive below freezing temperatures. And that should take care of the quagga mussels. However, with that question, I might note that it is illegal in the state of Utah to transport quagga mussels on any type of conveyance, whether they're alive or dead. So it behooves the boater to examine their boat and make sure that they don't have those on their boat. And if they do, to call us. We'll take care of the decontamination for them.
And then one other question, if I could, Mitch. Lake Powell has them. What other water in Utah has them right now?
We have 4 affected waters in Utah. Electric Lake in Red Fleet,
just right up here, right up the road, where we discovered veligers and DNA in those waters 5 years ago. If we continue with negative sampling, they will come off of our list this year. And to my knowledge, that will be one of the first, if not the first, declassification of a quagga-infested water, which is a tribute to our program in Utah and to Utah voters for taking care of these. We also have Sand Hollow Reservoir, where in 2010 we found one adult quagga mussel live. We have found DNA, but we've never found veligers, and it is currently coming back with negative samples for quagga mussels. And then we have Lake Powell, under which we're working with right now.
Appreciate the work you're doing on that. Those things are ugly.
Yeah. Well, it's a tribute to the voters, because really we can't do it all. We can educate the voters and those that really care about us will take care of the problem for us.
You know, not to drag this out, but my guess is there's a lot of people that don't understand why it's such a danger to have the quaggas in the water ecosystems. Do you mind touching on that just really briefly, give them kind of a rough outline of why that's such a problem?
Yeah. Well, let me start with the economics, because that's the big scary deal that most people don't understand. In the state of Utah, we move water all over the place through pipelines, through canals, and different conveyances such as that. Quagga mussels have a tendency to colonize very rapidly, and they colonize on top of each other. They can clog off pipes, and they can clog up canals, and reduce our ability to move water. They can also ruin equipment by clogging up boat motors and dam structures. And currently, we're spending about $2 million a year to prevent quagga mussels if we were to get them in our systems. We would probably be spending $15 to $16 million a year to treat them so that we can keep our water systems open. From the ecological perspective, quagga mussels are filter feeders, and they very efficiently filter water and make it so that our juvenile fish don't have the zooplankton available for them to grow. It's a huge detriment to our fisheries. From an aesthetics perspective, again, they pile up on each other. They die. They end up on shorelines. They ruin beaches, and they become very smelly as they decompose.
Any other questions? Jordan, I've got one. How do you keep track of those days?
How do we keep track of them?
The six, 3 days in the summer and then the days in the fall. Do you date when the people leave the water? Do you give them a some kind of a date and see?
Yeah.
And then how do they go to another lake? I guess they can tell. How do you keep track of those days?
On our affected waters, recently implemented a tagging program. As boats leave the water, they can be inspected by the state park personnel or Division of Wildlife personnel that are present to make sure they're cleaned and drained. They then get a tag on their boat that says the date that they are leaving and the water body that they're coming from. So as they show up to another water, the technician or a park manager that approaches the boat can look at that date and say, okay, you've been out of the water so many days, you're clear to launch, or please pull over here and we'll help you decontaminate the boat. Our Red Fleet Reservoir and Electric Lake and Sand Hollow are participating very well in that program. Lake Powell is managed by the National Park Service, and we're working with them. They are handing out our information, so boaters should be being educated, but currently they don't have the resources to tag every boat in the city. They have over 100,000 boat launches a year, and it's pretty tough to catch everybody. But we're working on a program. We're trying to get there. So.
Any questions from the public? Any comments from the RAC committee at this time?
Make one comment. The quagga mussel down in Lake Mead is horrendous. It is so ugly, you just can't believe it. You know, so monitoring, you know, river trips and different things, having them clean their boats also and some of that would be a challenge from the river running perspective.
Those boats that are running down the Colorado River to Mead have to be contaminated every time. That's the Arizona state law. But I might also note any boats that are coming north from Lake Mead up I-15 are now being stopped at our port of entry and inspected to make sure that they're not bringing any aquatic mussels into the sea.
Good.
Any other comment?
Question here. Jordan, are those shoulder seasons defined, and if so, what are those?
Right now we're defining them as months because that's easy for the public to understand. Summer season is June, July, and August. Shoulder seasons are March, April, May, and then September, October, November, and then the winter season is the end.
Any other comment? I don't see any comment cards, so we'll entertain a motion at this time for this action.
Move to accept as presented by the state.
Any second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you.
This next one don't look like much. Can you skip it?
I second that.
Okay, next we go to the Cougar Recommendations Action. John, she's all yours.
Contain your enthusiasm.
It's nice seeing folks again here. I'm John Shivick, Mammal Program Coordinator, and I'm going to present our recommendations for the latest next round of cougar permits and quotas, et cetera. But I do want to do a little background. We're now going to go into the fourth year of this current plan cycle. So there aren't a whole lot of changes in terms of the spatial or how things have been set up, just sort of tweaks in the system in terms of quotas and permits and things, but it is a really complicated plan and a really complicated setup, so I'm going to do a little background just to kind of set some framework a little bit. If we remember that the spatial scale is in a couple different ways, that is, people who are really familiar from not too long ago, of units, you know, each one of these smaller polygons is the units that they're familiar with for their animals. But when this plan was developed, what they did is they combined a lot of the units into separate areas. So these thicker lines are the areas, and the little polygons within them are units. And that becomes significant as we calculate quotas and permits and things. The hunt types are things people are familiar with, I'm sure, too. Again, limited entry, limited, you know, draw only, it's going to close, the end of May, split units. They're a little bit different in that they open as a limited entry. There's a certain number of permits that are available, and then it closes. Then there's about a week, and then it opens up again as a harvest objective. And then that unit will remain open until the area's quota or the closing date for that unit is achieved. Harvest objective units open most of the year. These only close if the area quota is achieved. Now, the unit types, and this is where, if there's anything that's going to look a little different in this year's guidebook versus last year's guidebook. Last year's guidebook, units were within areas, were combined in a way that really didn't sort work very well. And the reason that is because we not only have standard cougar management units, we also have units that are separated out under predator management plans, where there's worries about deer. So according to the plan, again, our standard management units has target management of proportion of female cougars in the harvest between 17% and 20%, tree per day 0.25 to 0.35, our measure of our effort. And then those units would be limited entry or split units typically. The predator management units, again, now these are different. Now, really the goal under these is not so much to really protect and keep the cougar population going. It's more of trying to protect the deer and really to remove cougars from those areas. So there's a target of a female harvest of greater than 25%. So you can see that those two management objectives are different. One is sort of keeping cougars. The other one's really trying to hit the cougars harder. And then the predator management units can be split or harvest objective, depending on what the local conditions say. So again, since these management targets are different, the units were separated up within the cougar management areas for quota purposes. All right. Now, what do I mean by the predator management policy? Units could be put into a predator management unit if the deer numbers hit certain thresholds. For instance, if the deer is less than 90% objective on that unit, and adult deer survival less than 85% for two of the past 3 years, or the survival on that unit is less than 80% for 1 year. So if the biologists look at this, managers look at this and are concerned, they might say, okay, we need this to be on a predator management plan. Okay. Now again, the spatial, because this is complicated, but I just want to drive this home a little bit. If we just pretend this square here is an area, remember that's how we're kind of thinking of cougars as this management area. We can then subdivide that area up into specific units. Some of those units might be the standard management units. Some might be under predator management. And there could be different numbers of each of these within any given area. And we'll see that as we go through the actual recommendations. So then on the standard management units and predator management units, they can be assigned, as I said before, certain strategies. Our standard ones could be limited entry or split. Our predator management could be split or harvest objective. Then the trick here is we tend to focus on, well, how many cougars did you remove from this unit or this unit or this unit? But that isn't the really be all end all in terms of the quotas. All of the cougars on all of these are summed to come up with one quota for this side, and all of these that are removed from this side are summed to come up with a quota for this side. So I really need to think of the whole area and not the specific unit when we're looking at these recommendations. Okay. Now the plan's pretty specific for how I calculate how many cougars are on the permits or quotas for any area. It's a flow chart. I don't have a whole lot of leeway. If this threshold's achieved, then this. If this threshold's achieved, then we raise or lower permits by that amount. For instance, I talked about those targets in the standard units, proportion of female in the harvest, 17% to 20%, and then the treat per day, and we adjust permits using the 3-year average. So for an example, average harvested females above 23% in that area, we reduce the tags or the quota by 20%. That's what the plan says to do. On predator management units, an example, again, we want to have a higher number of females in the harvest. We also adjust the quota looking at the last 3 years average of harvest. And on these, if there's an average adult female harvest, 20-25%, we might end up taking the average previous harvest and adding 50% to the quota. So the way the calculations are done a little different, but I didn't go into these details for every area because it's in the plan pretty set. I'd like to say it's straightforward, but there's a series of steps. Okay, so for actual recommendations, excuse me, hunt season dates. Not a whole lot different than what we have been seeing in the past. Limited entry, November 13th. This is an error there. I apologize for this. This actually should close on 5:30 the way they normally would. So November 13th to May 30th, 2014. The split units, what I described before, will start in November. They close on February 26th. They'll close for about a week to allow us to make sure we've got all our quotas and numbers and everything tabulated correctly. And they open again as harvest objective and remain open until the area closes or until end this May 30th. Harvest objective is almost a year-round thing. They'll start really similar to what we did a lot in previous years, November 13th to November 9th, 2014. And then the pursuit season, very similar to what we had seen before, just adjusted for Sundays, et cetera, going from November 13th to May 30th. I like to try to keep these things all lined up to be as simple as possible. Now, specific strategies and quotas, we'll go this, and this is where it gets a little confusing, but one of the things I really want people to focus on mostly as we go through these is this white box up here. We'll talk about an area, then we'll talk about whether they're a predator management unit group or whether it's the standard management group. And then what we'll look at is this white box is what's going to tell you what the overall quota is for all of these units combined in every one of these. On the bighorn sheep, these were set aside right from the beginning as places we're worried about the bighorn. So, recommending an unlimited quota of cougars on those areas, so those three units, where the goal is to keep cougar populations as low as possible in order to benefit the sheep. The book cliffs, I might spend a little more time on this one. This one is, again, go through the numbers on it, how we got to this, but these are the two predator, these are the book cliffs units are both predator management units. So that means these two, all of the numbers come up to one harvest quota. And because I know I'll get questions on it, I thought I'd go ahead and give the numbers on these ones in particular in terms of how we got where we are. For instance, for the book cliffs, Bitter Creek, the reason it went to predator management plan is because our objective for the deer population for the last 3 years was 0.47, 0.41, 0.49. So it's 50% lower than objective for that unit. And then the survival is 0.79, 0.81, 0.79. So it's always been below 85%. So what that has meant is that, and I can ask Dax about it too as we go through this, there's been a whole bunch of pressure and a whole bunch of worry about that deer herd and about it getting impacted. So there's a lot of pressure to make sure that we're doing things with cougar on these units and in this area and try to make sure these guys are okay. If we look at the cougar numbers, the percent adult female, remember the target's supposed to be 0.25 because it's under a predator management plan, but the percent adult females was 0.15, 0.17, 0.17, so an average of 0.17. So given those numbers, that's why we ended up coming up with book cliffs. It's still in the same, or that Bitter Creek still in the same area as it had been, but they've recommended a harvest objective in order to try to bump up that take a little bit. Instead of being a split, it had traditionally been a split. The because of those numbers, that's why that harvest quota is 40. The average take had been 20, but the plan says you bump it by 100% given those deer numbers. So that's how we got to that number. The cash, I'll go through these other ones a little more quickly, but again, the same sort of deal. Standard management units on the cash divided up into limited entry or split. The harvest objective or the harvest quota is 45, female sub quota 11. Again, the way this would work on the limited entry units, these 10 lucky people would get their limited entry permits through these. And then if they harvested 10, there'd still be, there'd be 35 left to take out these other units during that harvest objective point. So everything still sums together, and then what's taken out of the limit entry is knocked off of the whole quota. The Monroe is one of the more simpler ones just because all the units under the same management strategy. The harvest quota, 76, female subquota, 19, and then the number of permits in that limited entry, this is something that the biologists have a little leeway on to kind of figure out how many people get that sort of choice option first before the thing turns into harvest objective. The Oker Stansbury standard management units, some limited entry, some split. Overall harvest quota 30, the female subquota 8. And again, the Oker Stands in West Desert, they've got their limited entry, again, another 10 that could get taken out of those couple of units. And then everything else sums into the other split units. And then there's one predator management unit that was identified for a split, Fillmore Oak Creek. And the harvest quota on it is essentially the same as the number of permits that they put in there. So if everybody harvests, then this won't open as a harvest objective. Down south, standard management units on the Pine Valley, some split, some harvest objective. Harvest quota 24, female subquota 6. And then much of those are first given out as you know, split units, limited entry, and then again turning into harvest objective, depending on what's left. One thing I should point out too is this minimum. I neglected to say that. That's the same as we had seen previous years. If you have units with special, especially sheep concerns, those kinds of things, they might establish a minimum on it, because it is possible that 24 cougars are harvested and none are taken out of the Zion, but they want to ensure that at least 18 are taken out of the Zion. So even if these units close, this guy will stay open until that minimum of 15 are taken. Predator management units in San Juan, Henry's, LaSalle, the San Juan. The San Juan is different. Those two, it's a Bajo Elk Ridge, were combined this year into the one San Juan for various concern reasons, but it doesn't, it kind of turns out the same way. They're predator management units. They're under all under harvest objective, and they'll only close if we get this harvest quota of 52, which is up quite considerably from last year, 24, I think, based on the requirements of the plan and the deer numbers and cougar numbers. Uintah standard management units, total 14. The limited entry units divide up into Chalk Creek and the Wasatch Mountains, Current Creek. And so there's some opportunity for more limited entry units, even not too far away from here. The predator management unit side of it, however, harvest quota 48, female subquota 24 for those units. A couple of them with some minimums, just to make sure, as I said, these guys get the pressure that people want them to get. The Wasatch Mantis, we've seen some changes this year in recommendations. Standard management units, harvest quota 45, female sub of 15. There are some limited entry units there now that weren't there before. That Southwest Manti was particularly controversial over this last year. And so we ended up putting that as limited entry and having a reduced number of permits over the whole area, again, but still following the plan. And now we've got our split unit, so if these animals are all taken, you've got to take the rest to get 45 out of these during the harvest objective portion up till May. Predator management units on the Wasatch Manti, though. So these guys will stay as split and harvest objective. Harvest quota 44, female sub of 18. And the idea here, again, is to make these so these guys stay open in some of these places where we want to have cougar population more reduced and get people out there hunting in some of these other places and not just stuck in on the limited entry ones. That's it for the area by area perspective and take on it. There's some other edits in the guidebook and rule that I need to go through. And one of the proposals is no take of radio collared cougars on the Oak Ridge, Stansbury or Monroe unit due to ongoing research studies. We've got a pretty intensive research study on the Monroe now. That restriction had been on the Oak Ridge for a long time, but this study is pretty interesting on Monroe because we're starting to get GPS collars on cougars down there and watching as cougars are eating coyotes who aren't eating deer anymore. And that's kind of a neat thing to get a handle on. And it's been difficult as they're harvested as almost as quickly as they get collars on them. So we'll try to keep, at least for a couple of years, keep the collars once collared. The division requests a GPS location from where cougars were harvested. Had a lot of discussions with houndsmen, and we're trying to be as responsive as we can. So as people check in cougars, we hope that we can get GPS locations and get that in the database as well, and it could be helpful for all sorts of reasons. One other thing is there has been a 7-day restriction on harvest objective units, to prevent somebody from treeing a cougar and then running out and buying a license and then doing it that way. But 7 days is a little extreme. 3 days makes a little more sense. So even our law enforcement guys were thinking that this was a good idea. So we're proposing to change that 7-day to a 3-day wait after buying a harvest objective permit. There are some boundary classifications. I did not go through all the details details of these. The RAC members, you have extensive descriptions of those in your packets. But they're all fairly simple in the sense that over the last couple of years, the deer units have changed. They kind of got out of alignment with what our cougar units are, and it got confusing. And then we had some units where there is a sliver between the two because as one got adjusted, the other didn't get adjusted. So this is just some bookkeeping in order to get our units all right. There's nothing that's been really moved or put someplace different. It's just adjusting to make follow a drainage instead of a road, for instance, that are within a few hundred yards of each other sometimes. But it's simple stuff. So more or less to summarize, it's not, we're still following the same pattern that we had been. We still have our areas. We still manage on the area. Then we do it on units. In terms of overall, we have 8 limited entry units versus 11 before. This number is a split. Numbers of harvest subjective are somewhat similar. Again, the 16 is because that San Juan is now 1 instead of 2 units, so there's a little different numbers down there. But and then what we can see spatially, what we're recommending, what is just looked at is there's some of the pink that's up here is moved down over here and more conglomerated and added some units down there. So it's a really big balancing act in order to try to do what the plan says, which is to ensure that we've got cougar populations around, but try to balance that against the needs of people and other wildlife. So with that, I do want to make one more final comment as we go into questions and things. And so our last couple meetings have been, it felt more like an episode of the Jersey Shore or something, a public process. And I hope what I want to really get across is the idea here, this is a public meeting. I'm here to get input. We're here to try to tweak the system and to hear from people. What I'm trying to do is also balance. For every one hound, I'm not even going to name names or anything like that. For everybody that looks at it this way, there's another few people that look at it this way. So we're not up here to tell you this is the way it is, this is the way it's got to be, because I'm smarter than you or anything, because I know you guys are a lot smarter than me in a lot of stuff. But what we're trying to do is just balance this. So what I'm hoping, and I do really like hard questions, and I think you should push us to the wall and really make sure we're doing our jobs. But at the same time, I'm hoping we'll be, let's try to come to figure things out rather than, going through Judge Judy or something like that and making it really controversial. So, but I do think we've had really good crowds, and I'm really excited. There's so many people that are so excited and pumped up about these animals and are willing to participate and be here. So, with those comments, I conclude my presentation.
John, I got to tell you one thing. You remind me of an old calculus professor. Anyway, thanks, John.
I do have a PhD, but it didn't help this stuff, I got to tell you.
It's changed a lot.
Anyway, any questions from the rack members at this time?
I got one for John. You have a slide up there, I think, that showed the predator management criteria.
Mm-hmm.
Can you go back to that?
Right at the beginning.
Yeah.
So if
we're kind of I think most of us probably interested in the Buck Cliffs and the 9 Mile area. Are we saying that the deer population in those two areas, since we're kind of looking at maybe a management plan in that area, that we're 90% below our objective?
It's less than that. It's more around 50% of objective for that Buck Cliff area. So you want it to be, if the deer are less than 90% of objective, that's when they start saying, hey, we might need to tweak the system. So that's the threshold right there. So it's justified on a cougar unit if deer are less than 90% objective and the survival is low too, adult survival is low. It's actually more complicated, surprise, surprise. If it's fawn survival that's low, then we sort of target coyotes. If it's adult survival that's low, then we're thinking it's more of a cougar issue. So it could go either way, but I'm just focusing on the cougar side of things in the predator management policy here.
Okay.
Any other questions from RAC members?
Has the Buck Cliffs as a split unit ever filled its quota without the harvest objective? since they went to that?
Yeah, again, see, I'm thinking in terms of areas, not in, because so it doesn't, you know, have the quota. So the areas, let me see where we are, if I've got that, those numbers for Cougar Take. Yeah, I've got some too. Well, no, I mean, overall, it's the average is 20. The quota's been 26, 26, 26. So it typically doesn't. Nope, 9.
Mr. Chairman?
Well, 13, 23, 24. So, no, it hasn't been doing that. It hasn't been touching the quota. And that's pretty typical to, thanks, Dax, to a lot of our units. Statewide, the quota is up in around 400 or something. Our typical Cougar Take is in the 300s. So that's not out of the normal.
In 2009, which was the last year before we combined the Book Cliffs and Nine Mile together for the quota, in 2009 we did reach the quota in the Book Cliffs. But that's the only time, I think, that we have. And since, I think I have data back to 1990.
Any other questions for Dax or John, MRAC members?
I've already ran this through Dax, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What kind of handle do you have on the actual population numbers for cougars?
We don't have much of a handle other than the plan's more or less educated guess of around 3,000 for the state.
Okay.
Those kinds of numbers, though, are real. It's so you get an average density, and you kind of put overlay density on the areas and come up with something. Those aren't really good, and so what we tend to do, especially with large carnivores, is we can't estimate populations and numbers very well. We find indices. We try to find something that we can use to indicate whether that population is going up or that population is going down. As it turns out with cougars, that percent adult female tells you something. Based on the research, a lot of it came out of Idaho. That looks like how they put this plan together. If you start having, it's a lot with same as with bear too. If you tend to start really hitting females hard, you're going to start driving that population down. If you're not hitting the females as hard, then your population has ability to grow better.
And all of that data is collected post-harvest, so we wouldn't technically know what the population trend was until the harvest had been completed or the objective had been reached, and that data could be analyzed.
Right. So, and that's another reason why we do this in a three-year cycle, a three-year chunk, because any one given year, you know, at percent, what's a percent female of if you've harvested five animals? One versus
right.
Two is not a good number for percentages. It's all out of whack. So that's why we'll take a three-year block, do a percent adult female where you have a decent number of females in there, and then use that. So it has to be, you know, we're always kind of a little bit looking in the rear view mirror and try to nudge the system one way or the other.
Because there's really no way to objectively find out how many animals there actually are in the state. So we're kind of flying by the seat of our pants based on what people chose to harvest and how many people would harvest an adult female. And this is something that I'll have to ask you guys because I've never been in the field to do this. But I'm guessing that there's some houndsmen that would be willing to take an adult female versus some who absolutely strictly would not, absolutely would not, and would hunt until they got an adult male. Some people might get a kitten. It's hard to say. So it depends on the discretion of the hunter in addition to a lack of research. This is all just kind of political.
I wouldn't say it's all political, but it's not all biological.
Okay.
So what it is, it's biology plus sociology and weighing deer with cougar, with people, with different, even among houndsmen, believe it or not, there are different opinions too. So, you know, there's everybody's got a different perspective on everything. So what we're trying to do is weigh all that, put it through the sausage-making process, and come out with these recommendations. We don't have a rigorous way to get population estimates. We do have on the site, we are encouraging people to learn what a male is from a female, and we are encouraging people to know that and to be able to choose a big tom and know what a big tom is versus a young 2-year-old female or something. So we do want we are encouraging that. And if people do that and they do choose the, you know, the right thing from that perspective, then they can keep more females out there and then keep that population more robust and more healthy, at least from that perspective. Again, as a biologist, it's still way more complicated than that, but that's kind of the, those are sort of the guidelines.
I realize this is a drastic question, but it's a question that has been brought to me. Are we going to wipe out the population of mountain lions on the 9 Mile and Book Coast by raising the harvest objective to that high? Are we going to wipe out the entire population?
Likely no. Well, first off, I mean, there's when something goes under predator management plan, the goal is to impact that population. The way the plan is set up, the goal is to have source areas, so these limited entry units, these places where there are more cougars, and then sink areas, which is where, you know, to put it bluntly, kind of where cougars go to die. Okay. And this is this balancing of deer, cougar, people, and everything. And whether or not they're going to be wiped out completely, probably not. There's enough source areas around it. But if you're worried about, if you're thinking you're going to get there a big tom there or something, the populations are going to, are likely to be impacted in for instance, in that unit.
So in terms of quality of the cougar?
If you're only looking at cougar, this is where, I mean, I got to dance on a tightrope here because it's cougar, it's deer, it's people, it's everything. And the way the plan was designed and what we're following through, that area, those are designed to impact the cougar populations based on what's going on with deer. And, that's the short answer.
So here's the million-dollar question. On the list of things that actually impact the deer herd, where is the cougar on that list?
That's a very good question.
I thought so, too.
It's going to depend. You can definitely have situations where you can kill as many cougars or coyotes or anything, and you're not going to see more deer. You can have situations where you remove cougars, you remove coyotes, and you can release deer herd. The difficulty is there's two difficulties. One, if we see a deer herd really being hit, there's a lot of pressure. Dax may want to speak to this in terms of, or maybe he doesn't want to speak to this, in terms of pressure to go out there. I'll just be really frank and honest with you guys. There's pressure to do something. And if killing a cougar saves one deer in a lot of people's minds, that's enough. So if we're doing our best. We're trying to help the deer. We're trying to protect cougar. We're trying to do it all. What'll happen is we'll see after this next cycle, did that deer herd rebound? And if it didn't, then we have to ask ourselves, and this is in the plan as well, that if predator management plans aren't working or having an effect on the unit, we need to rethink the predator management on that unit. So that is there. The thing is now, the way it is, we're still in this 3-year cycle, so I can't answer that question until 3 years from now, whether or not we actually helped or. And it's going to depend on what's happening with winter and summer and or with other with weather conditions and everything too. It's not a perfect science. It's about nudging a system one way or another, and then looking and adapting based on what we did.
Based on historical data, how much impact does predation have on a deer herd?
It depends on whose historical data you refer to. There's a lot of controversy in this. There's a bunch of studies that have been done on it. About half show that predator control help. About half show that predator control don't help. They all show that, or the big recommendation is, if there's evidence that the deer herd is being held down by predation, that's the time to go in and do predator control. And so that's where these guys are looking at. We got a 50% lower than objective. What's going on? Could be a predation trigger here. So that's how we came through. So it's not, and that's what I said before, it's not always if you kill cougars, you're going to get doubling a deer. No, that doesn't. Sometimes you will, sometimes you won't.
When did the mule deer trend start on a pretty accelerated decline, would you say?
So just for this, for the state, for this.
Sure, let's go statewide.
The interesting thing is statewide, we're actually been stable for 10 years now.
Okay.
But on any given unit, you know, again, this it's that scale. There's what up here and down there, and up here and down there, and we're trying to nudge the system.
Right. On a mass trend, though, so let's say rather than looking at a 3-year cycle, which could be severely impacted by a horrible winter, let's talk about 20 years. When did we start seeing a deceleration trend?
And I'll let Dak come and talk about. I think we should probably focus on.
Well, it correlates. It correlates back into it. We can talk about 9 Mile and Book Close. That's just fine.
You know, I got deer population numbers here for the last, you know, dozen years. Our objective in the Book Close is 15,000 deer. And, you know, we range from 6,200 last year. Let's see, our highest was 2006, 8,500. You know, that was 57% of the objective. So, I mean, numbers have bounced around. The largest driver of that is probably weather conditions. But, you know, our adult doe survival numbers are what's concerning to us right now. And we have a pretty good sample of 100 radio collared does every year. We're replacing our mortalities each year. And, you know, our target is to be above 85%. And we've had, you know, 79, 81, and 79% survival on adult does. And half of the mortality in our adult does has occurred in the summer range. And so, you know, when you have that mortality in the summer, it typically is an indication that predation is a cause of that mortality versus, you know, your winter mortality a lot of times is related to nutritional stress, you know, hard winter. So there's some predation in the winter as well, but that summer mortality is concerning to us. Our adult doe survival rate is concerning to us. As far as, you know, reaching that 15,000 objective for deer in the Book Close, you know, I don't know if we can get there. It's going to, a lot of things are going to have to come together and line up. And predator management is probably a piece of that puzzle, but I don't know that it's a silver bullet to save deer herd out there either.
Of the 20% mortality that you've had, and I understand, you know, it's a press for time to get out there when those mortality beacons do go off. Do any of your necropsies suggest that it is nutritional deficiency, or I mean, what are you finding on those results?
You know, our guys that are picking up the collars aren't here tonight. I can't answer you. I can't tell you for sure what they're finding. I mean, I know a lot of times when we pick up those dead deer, we'll break open the femur and look at the marrow. If an animal's nutritionally stressed when it dies, the marrow and the bone will be red, bright red, because they're starting to metabolize their own bone marrow. Mm-hmm. But that still doesn't necessarily mean that they died from malnutrition. They could have been killed by a predator, and maybe they would have recovered. So, I mean, that can give you an idea, but it's still hard to tell. I wish our guys that recovered the collars were here tonight. Our habitat section is actually taking the lead on the study because it was started in conjunction with the paving of the Seabridge Road.
Okay.
But I don't have that information.
Which I'm sure helps the whole scenario. Okay, last question. Can you speak on the benefits of predators to a deer herd? You're welcome.
This is fun. Again, that depends on your perspective. And there are some arguments over this kind of thing, too. Some of the hard data that I can think of right off hand. Study out of Colorado is pretty interesting in terms of chronic deer infected with chronic wasting disease, much, much more likely to be taken by cougars than by general hunters. Other things in the Lindsay stuff in Utah years ago, the cougars did tend to take the older senescent animals as well. They're kind of more specializing in those things that are on their way out anyway. But so those would be potential benefits in terms of, you know, the calling of the sick and the weak kind of thing. But that's going to be in the situation again when if you've got a healthy deer herd and all else is equal, then they can do that perfect calling and stuff. If you've got a situation where those predators or these deer are in trouble for other reasons, then it can be counterproductive. So again, it's where that threshold is, where what the habitat's doing, the weather's doing, where the deer are, and where the cougar are.
Okay. Game on. Thank you.
Any other questions from RAC members?
I've got one. I'll ask. I'm not a much of a cougar hunter. I've actually never put in for a permit, but I assume that since it's a limited entry that there's a preference point system associated with it. Is that right? Do you have any numbers on what those preference point holders are that if we go to this, they'll more or less lose out on their preference points because it'll be an over-the-counter purchase? What are the how many years have they been putting in? Is it two or three, or is it more like five or six?
I didn't pull numbers, but people have assured me that they've been saving for years and years. So I can clarify that is what they lose out of. If they were trying to save for this year to do their limited entry hunt by themselves, they could be impacted. But they could be impacted if we had that as a limited entry portion. We could have 40 permits there, or 20 permits there, or 10 permits there. So how the quality of that hunt and whether it's worth the cash in those points or not is going to be up to them. The thing about this particular unit is if it's split, it'll be just like it was before as a split. But if they wanted to hunt it at that same time, they would hunt it as a limited entry. They're just buying a harvest objective and not losing the points, which they could go and use over on the Wasatch or something like that. So it's a real fine point as far as which way you want to choose to make that thing split or make that harvest objective in terms of what people think and want for their quality of their hunt during that time. If I may, I hope I didn't babble through that too much.
So actually, they could use those points elsewhere. If they still in the state, they can use them. But if we go to a harvest objective on this one, they can still get one over the counter if they're lucky enough. But they wouldn't be able to use them in an area that they might have been putting in for.
Yeah, they're not even lucky enough. And I understand some of the current concerns. A concern would be, maybe someone will bring this up. I mean, I could see a scenario where someone saved up, they want to do it. Now they're worried if it goes harvest objective, then the cougars will be impacted. And then there's going to be no sense trying to do it as a limited entry or split 3 years from now. So until 5 years from now when the cougars come back, if we manage differently or something. So you're right. I mean, the decision we make right now could incrementally do something a few years in the future. And I don't have the perfect answer for that. How do we balance when something's been a split and turning into harvest objective and people thought it was going to be that way forever? I don't have a really good answer.
Any other questions from the RAC committee? I'll turn the time over to questions to the public now, but I'd like to have you come up to the mic and speak. That way we can get at you.
My name is Daniel Davis, and the first question I have, well, this is a three-year cycle that the state's proposing. In that three-year cycle, is there a possibility of harvesting 40 lions per year just off of the Bitter Creek unit alone, which combining all 3 years, 120 lines potential?
Excuse me, we need you to state your name too, okay? Did you?
Yeah. The way it's set up, again, this is an area. So if nobody hunts the 9 mile and doesn't remove any cougars from the 9 mile, and they all go to and pile up on the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek, you would remove 40 cougars or 20 female 20 subquota of 20 from that area before it would shut down.
With a potential of 120 in that 3 year.
Well, or 40 per year. You know.
That's my only question.
Any other questions from the public? Yes, sir.
My name is Brad Evans. I'm a local sportsman and a guide for elite outfitters in Vernal, Utah, and I'm a member of the Utah Houndsman Association. And your slides were kind of fast, and we went through them pretty quick. So I just have one question for you to clarify for us. If the division cougar proposal passes, will there be any split units in the northeastern region?
As is right now, if it goes as it is, in the northern region?
Northeastern region.
Well, that's mainland entry, the rest will be harvest objective.
Yeah.
So no, there wouldn't be a split unit in the northeastern region.
Any other questions?
Yes, sir. My name is Michael Merrill. Just concerned citizen. I love the outdoors. Love lion hunting, bear hunting. Can you go over your last slide real quick? I just had a question on it.
This guy's the maps?
Yeah, the maps. On your cougar management area, can you distinguish this a little bit? Is the one on the right the proposed?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't explain that very well. And I'm just noticing that it does show the book host as a split here.
Can we keep
that's
that
fine. So, or the
entry. We would agree with that.
No. Yeah, I see that. I see that. This is what it had before, and what I was trying to demonstrate is sort of a, and again, this is, you know, we're not through our cycle yet, so I don't know what this map is going to look like until we're done with our public process, but this is going to give you that visual representation of we're moving some of the limit entries up here down into other places.
Okay, just looking at this real quick. As we talked about just a little bit before, the whole northeastern region does not have any, well, there's one right here.
Limited
entry. So you have
plus that.
So you have these two that may supply lions over to this area. Because right now the north, everything in the north is the cougar management. And I had the question of how long has it been in the cougar management to where open season all year round?
For the north slope?
For the north slope.
I don't know.
Run that way about 10 years.
Our north slope biologist is here.
Oh, there's
Jake. It's a bighorn sheep area, so as long as there's been sheep, it's been in predator management.
Okay, have you noticed a deer increase?
That's one of the few subunits in our region that's actually close to objective. The Vernal Diamond Bonanza and then the Daggett County, those two units are pretty close to objective for our deer.
What is the objective?
Oh.
I say it's like 6,000 or 8,000 for the north slope, and it's combined with
the. So you're at 80% thereabout?
Yeah, those units, the North Slope, Daggett County area, would not qualify for predator management for lions based on deer, but because of the bighorn sheep there, it does.
Okay, thank you. Couple of concerns. If it does go to predator management in the book, sir,
they have to be questions.
Oh, okay. How many kittens do you think you're going to be taking in the Bitter Creek unit?
Legally none.
That's right.
I don't know. We have law enforcement here, John. How many tickets we've written to individuals in the northeast region that have taken kittens in the last? Do you have any idea on that?
Off the top of my head, no. But if there are kittens taken, we want to know about it.
And I'm sure they would. They would probably come checking in. That just a concern that I have. And then the last thing. Randy touched on it. I know people that have 6 points that have been putting in for 6 years that have invested $60 already for that unit, and they don't know anywhere else in the state to go to this limited entry. So it is a concern. I mean, they could have bought a tag already and went up north.
This is a question of during our comment period.
Sorry,
you can come back up and we can.
I'm sorry.
Back. Another question?
Yes, sir. My name is Aaron Johnson with the Utah Houndsman Association. John, maybe you could clarify for me a couple of things. And we've had discussions about this plan in the past and we all going forward. I honestly don't know, and you told me this. I'm sorry, just let me get to the question real quick. The regional biologists give you recommendations on whether it stays limited entry or harvest objective, is that correct?
Yes.
Do you know if the regional biologists for this area contacted any of the local houndsmen and got suggestions before they recommended that this move from a split to a harvest objective? I honestly don't know. I don't know if that was done.
Definitely was the case with the
youth.
I don't know that there was communication. I know Clint Sampson's the biologist there, and he's not there. He's not here tonight. He's actually in the booklets right now at another meeting. But I know Clint communicates with the houndsman pretty regularly, but I don't know that there was formal consultation with the houndsman about this specific, you know, decision to recommend the booklet has become a harvest objective unit versus a split unit.
Okay. In the future, is it possible that before these recommendations are made to you, to where you submit the proposal, that those communications can be done with houndsmen, maybe through the Utah Houndsman Association, so that we could have a voice on, hey, we want this to stay split, and it doesn't become an issue? Is that something that we could look at maybe do in the future?
Yes.
Does the plan allow that?
Of course. And it is something that, and actually we've done, and my protocol when I do this, when I do the trapping orientation, the fur bearer, I have the UTA, I have a sit down with UTA, and I actually did have a sit down with Dan with the houndsman as well. What I'm finding though is, you know, a lot of these issues come out more of, it's really hard to communicate with everybody in the entire state and every region and it constantly, and there's always a person missed here and there. And I think even with the Houndsman Association, things weren't necessarily going all the way, getting over to Dan Carcane is my contact. So when I have a cougar issue or when I bring up stuff or I'm doing things, I call Dan up. Dan comes to Salt Lake. I've gone down to visit him, and we go over things. So that process is already established. I'm perfectly, and I'm sure we're all willing to do more of that. But then the nice thing is, I don't think that it's a broken system. What I think is that's the reason for these, too, is to make sure if someone did fall through the crack, is then you still have your day where you know we'll be here and you can ask these questions. So, we're doing our best to communicate, and that's why we're here.
And then just one small question to clarify it. According to the plan, and I have it over there, if the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek unit were to stay a split unit, that falls completely in the parameters of the plan.
Yes, it'd
okay.
be
placed before.
Any other questions from the audience? Okay, now we'll move into the comments. And I'd like to say I'm impressed. This is what I like to see in the communities. Representation from the people. I bet we've got, I've never seen quite a stack like this. I bet we've got everybody in the room that's on here. So what I'd like to do, streamline this, but still get the representation. So I've sorted these. These are all houndsmen's comments. And I believe I was told, is there a representative that we could start with? Brad Evans?
Yeah.
I kind of understand that. Would you want to start us off then, Brad?
Sure. My name is Brad Evans. I'm a member of the Utah Houndsman Association, and we would just like to make a proposal here tonight. As members of the Utah Houndsman Association, we would like to help the division in achieving their goal of bringing the deer herd numbers up in the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek unit. We also would like to see the number of cougar tags in the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek unit increased. We agree with the number of cougars the division wants to harvest, but we would like to see the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek unit left as a split unit. For the past 3 years, the unit has had 15 tags available. We would like to see this number increased by 33%, allowing sportsmen 20 tags for harvesting. By increasing the amount of tags to 20, we feel this will help the division reach their goal of 40 cougars between the two units. The reason we would like this area left a split unit is to give the sportsmen residents of Utah the majority of opportunity to harvest these cougars. We would like the Division of Wildlife to consider leaving this unit open until the goal of 20 has been reached. If the division was to open this area to a harvest objective unit, we feel the majority of harvesting would be done by non-residents and outfitters from other areas. We are also concerned with the two units being united as one, there is the potential of over-harvesting the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek unit in the first couple of years. This would directly affect the quality of hunt for houndsmen for years to come. We would like to ask the RAC to accept the Division of Wildlife Cougar proposal with the amendment of changing the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek unit back to a split unit. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad. What I'd like to do now, to keep from having too much reputation, negative representation, how many of the houndsmen support what Brad has just said? How many that, is there any of the hounds that would like to add to it? Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Aaron Johnson. I'm actually on the board for the Utah Houndsman Association. I passed out a letter, and Dan Cockcane emailed you guys a letter. I hope you had a chance to read through that. And I don't want to read it here. You guys can read through it. I just want to touch on a couple of the points. First and foremost, the Hound Association is the voice for the Utah Houndsmen in the state of Utah. We're the largest organization that represents the most houndsmen. We support the local houndsmen here and their local clubs and what they want to see happen here. We support the division's proposal. We feel that this proposal more closely follows the plan that's set forth. Going forward from here, we would like to possibly revisit the plan in the future, and we can work with John on those issues and maybe make the plan easier for everyone to follow and understand. But we'd also like to thank John for his time. We know that there was a lot of hard work put in this, and we really feel that he's following the plan as it's laid out, whether we like it or not, as closely as he can. On the second point, we agree with the GPS coordinates. On the third point, we'd like to make the voluntary cougar orientation course mandatory, or at least kind of look at that. And the reason for that is we feel that cougars or mountain lions are a trophy animal. And many of the people hunting these animals are going to shoot one in their entire life, probably the majority of the people. And making this mandatory, it just might increase the possibility and the probability that someone chooses a trophy animal and is prouder of that trophy, or at least has the knowledge to choose that trophy animal versus a smaller one that they may not be as proud of. And we think that there's a lot of good information in that course, and we'd like to see that be a mandatory course like it is on the bear. And then the fourth point, we feel that the best way to harvest the mountain lions and the cougars is a limited entry. Much like you guys, a lot of people might feel that way about the deer. The limited entry units provide the very best hunting opportunity in the state. And we feel that way about the cougars. We understand that they're not all going to be that way, and there's got to be a balance here. And what we're asking here in this rack is to leave this booklet as a split unit and allow people like myself that have 6 or 7 points, I don't know what, to draw this tag and have the opportunity to go there and shoot a trophy animal. And not that I wouldn't if it wasn't a harvest objective, but it would become more of a race to get out there and get it before somebody else. If we propose to do something like that to the Henry Mountains Deer Unit, you'd have to have police presence here to calm people down. So we encourage you just to keep it a trophy unit for us and keep it a split. Real quick, and I'll finish. The concern is that we can over harvest the Bitter Creek unit and hurt the lion population, and it's happened. It happened last year, not on this unit, but in a different unit in the state of Utah, and we had to ask the division to do emergency closure. It's a real concern. We feel like that could happen here. So we just encourage you to listen to the houndsmen. They raised their hand. They've come out. They've followed the process. They've done everything that they've been asked to, send emails, contact people, and we strongly encourage this RAC to do their part and vote with the outdoorsmen in this area for what they want. Thank you.
Thank you. Would anybody else from the houndsmen as a group like to add any more to this? Anybody disagree with any of it, with the houndsmen? Now, everybody's got a right to come up and speak if they fill one of these out, so don't let me try to put anybody down. Brittany, you want to come up?
Thanks,
brother. I wanted to hear from her. Oh, you got to come up. Anyway, well, we appreciate that. That helped things go smoothly, and we appreciate it.
Mitch.
I plan on talking before we're done.
Well, yeah, you're on one of these. You're not with the hounds. This is the hound.
Yeah, I'm a hound.
Yes, sir. But did you put yourself down as a houndsman or individual?
Probably individual sportsman, yeah.
That's what we're going to go to next.
Okay, good enough for you.
Wow. Two other there. Let's go with Dennis Abram. Boy, I picked you out just right.
Dennis Ingram, as already stated. And I sat on the rack here for 7 years, first 7 years they had it. And so I have a long history with this Cougar thing. I wish I had the dates in my head, I don't really. But about 95 or 96, we went to Harvest Objective in this region, and Booklets was one of them. This split season just came about the last 3 years, I believe. So we were in Harvest Objective from 1995 to about 2008 or 9 or 7. And we did not wipe out the population of the book clubs. You control that by the number you want to take, not by special limited entry tags. And by the way, I do not support that type of hunting. I support letting people hunt and controlling the harvest by the limit you take. If you take too many, you can reduce that next year. That's what I support. I support more opportunity, not more take. And I don't support corralling the tags for a handful of people that are lucky. You turn into a lottery system instead of a sporting event. If those people want to kill the tom, they should get a pack of dogs and train them and learn how to go hunt them and go kill one if that's what they want to do. But to expect and mandate that I stay home so they can kill one, I don't support that type of hunting. And so for that reason, I support the division's recommendation down the line for a harvest objective, that's what you want. If the division makes a decision split on a split unit, that's okay too. But anyway, I do support the division and what they want to manage the Cougars on all the units. And I do support the harvest objective on the South Slope. And I think that's the only two that have been moved in this northeastern region. So so people haven't been putting in for 6 or 8 or 10 or 15 years to hunt the book clips. Because I believe if we go back in records, we'll see this split stuff started 3 or 4 years ago. And they could have hunted the book clips for the last 20 years by buying a tag over the counter every year. That's a fact. So anyway, that's what I got to say. I support Mark's objective and I support year round hunting. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dennis. Okay, well, next we'll go to Steve Myler.
Yeah, Dennis is sportsman, but I support what the Hounds Association is.
So you support. with that
yeah.
Okay, Clay McCackney, Book Cliffs Landowner Association.
I'm Clay McCackney. I think most of the boys here know me. They've either had dogs on our property or whatnot, but we know them all. As a landowners association, we absolutely support the division and what they want to do with the harvest objective. I handed out flyers or a little paper there that kind of showed, even when this thing was open, we weren't getting the job done. You know, we were, 90%, 50% some years. I mean, lion hunting is a couple decent days a year when the snow's right. And so you've got to have an opportunity to get out there and get it. The more people you have out there to get it done, you know you're going to get it done. Or get closer to it. We're never going to hit 100%. It's not going to happen. You know, I think these guys, you know, they know it too. But, so anyway, that's our two bits. I think if we had maybe mentioned that this affected the deer herd, we'd have had a lot more numbers of people show up tonight, you know, to support this. But just based on a cougar agenda item, you know, a lot of people just overlooked it.
Clay, did you give Gail a copy of your paper that
I don't put know up here? Who
Gail. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Gail. She's been here so long that I just figure everybody knows Gail.
Just don't get mad. Okay.
Thank you.
I don't think it's chance I will.
Morgan, Berkeley, you want to write
it? I'm just Morgan Burchill. I represent the Northeastern Utah chapter of the SCI tonight. I'd just like to say I support the Utah Houndsman Association in keeping it a split unit. And basically, I just wanted to show up and voice my voice of support for our chapter. That's all I had to say.
Thanks, Morgan. Kent Bowden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the work that he puts into these endeavors.
I know you've put a lot of work into it. I represent Utah Trappers Association and am here in support of the plan, which is just a plan. Every plan has holes, has been pointed out. There's always going to be a few holes that will have to be worked out in the process. So as a whole, we do support the plan as proposed. And with the input of the houndsman, these holes can be sewn up and make it. And with time, can make it where it really should be as a finished document. Thank you.
Kent, I won't put, you've got Fur Bear on the go too, so did you want to speak on them too later?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I won't throw this away then.
Thank you.
Mr. Byron Bateman, front and center, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Byron Bateman, I'm the president of Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. We support the division's recommendation that they put out here on the book list, because when we go to the mule deer and the elk and the numbers and stuff every year, we keep decreasing the number of tags for deer tags and stuff on the book list unit. We're losing our youth and our opportunity for our youth to have a good deer hunt. This deer herd, we shut it down. It got so bad for several years. Then we opened it back up as a limited entry. And I don't think we want to go there again. But there's two types of predator management plans. There's one for cougars, and there's also one for coyotes. We helped get passed the Mule Deer Protection Act a year ago, which put $1.3 million of money towards specifically coyote predation on mule deer. And there's been a lot of a major effort that was done on the north part of the book list this year with aerial gunning through wildlife services to help decrease, you know, predation on mule deer. Nobody wants to see, you know, anybody losing a hunting opportunity. I'm also a houndsman. If you look in the guidebook and the pictures that are in the guidebook, my name is by almost every one of those pictures in that guidebook. I've got a lot of experience hunting lions in the state of Utah. There's also a lot of peer-related papers have been published on the Monroe Lions study that you can look at and see, specifically dealing with sink and source populations. This area is unique in that it has 1.4 million acres of Indian tribal lands within that gray area within your region. You also have national monuments, national parks, and stuff like that where there's no hunting allowed. So on a source sink, you've got a lot. When you take out a lion, there's several lions waiting to come in and take that lion's place. And if you go there and look at, you know, Dr. Stoner's, you know, doctoral paper and stuff, he did that, and Dr. Wolf, and then I just got a master's thesis from a young man, Dustin Mitchell, just completed his master's thesis that I read through. But this is the longest studied lion study in the states or anywhere in the country is the one we've done on the Monroe, and plus the one we just completed on the Kennecott Copper. So we have a lot of information as to what the populations, how we determine populations. It's not just a, you know, a wild guess. It's more of a scientific guess as to what the population is within the state. And if you read those papers, it'll give you a better understanding as to, you know, how lions actually come and fill back in these different areas. But Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, we want to see this deer herd come back out here and get it back up to where it's been. You know, the last 15 years, you look at those graphs and those charts and stuff in there, we haven't even come close. You know, we haven't hit 60%. We go to predator management when we get below 90, but we can't even get above 60. So we need to do something different. So I think that the division's come up with a good plan. And we never have hit, except like, you know, Dax pointed out, the one year that we did hit the 14 is what we allowed. And we did harvest 14 out of like 13 years or something like that. So we're not going to, you know, we might knock the lions back for a few years, but they rebound really fast. You see the picture right there. They usually have two or three kittens every year and stuff like that. So they can reproduce real fast, and those females start to breed at you know, year and a half to 2.5 years old. So I just ask that you go along with the division's recommendation. Let's look at the long-term benefit for, you know, houndsmen and deer hunters and everybody else in the state of Utah, that we rebuild our deer herds, keep it healthy. Get the deer herd back, we can increase the number of lions that we have on the unit. So, and that's kind of the long-term goal for everybody, is to have healthy populations of all of our wildlife in the state of Utah. Thank you.
Byron?
Yes, sir.
Good question for you. On the Sportsman Amendment, where do you stand on that?
On
their amendment? I mean, the Townsman's Amendment.
We didn't talk about that. We had a meeting with our fulfillment committee and voted on stuff. Well, it was a week ago last Monday when we had our committee together and voted on it. So I really can't comment on that because we didn't take the opportunity to discuss that. But numbers can be tweaked in there to reach the goals and stuff like that. So it just kind of, you know, you might have to increase the numbers like we do on the different units. But those numbers that are put out are not to obtain 100% harvest on any of those numbers that go out. And, you know, Boyd knows that. He's part of this process over the years. So, I don't know, what is the number, Boyd, what we shoot for with success rate on limited entry and, you know, split units?
Well, there again, it depends on, a lot depends on whether it's under an harvest objective, or I mean,
limited entry. Or,
yeah, limited entry or
harvest
objective, or if you're under a predator management, there's a lot of things involved, and that's why I leave the big bucks to John there.
He's the
best. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's why we do have that female quota in there, so we won't over harvest that. When we do hit that female quota of 20, it shuts it off. So there is triggers in there like that with everything, just to make sure that we don't over harvest. So there are safeguards.
Appreciate that.
Thanks, sir.
Mr. Hackett?
Yes. Is it possible one of our houndsmen could get up and I know that you gave me the opportunity to agree, but readdress some of those things?
Well, yeah, I've got to give you a little leeway because I didn't let everybody come
right
up and speak.
And I don't know if someone else wants to do it or if I can speak on behalf of the club. All right.
Yeah, I want, if there's anything that needs to be added or anything
have
else.
Have someone else do
that's,
it?
No. I will allow it because we didn't go through every individual.
I appreciate that.
So, well, thank you.
My name is Jared Bergman, and I support the Utah Hounds Association proposal. And I just had a few things. Byron brought up that there's areas surrounding these places that other cougars can move in, but there's not in the book list. You've got Unit 21 on the east side of it. That's an open harvest objective, and they do the same thing. They just wipe them out there. And every other unit surrounding that is there's nowhere for cougars to move in. If we do this, because it's all going to be harvest objective. And is there anything else you want to add?
If you'll give me another opportunity, I'd love to.
But it's up to you. I've made that clear that if we need to add to this, it's going to make it'll go a little smoother than having every individual come up. So I'm giving you the leeway.
Thank you, sir. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah.
I don't want this to squelch and make us all cry. Hey, we completely respect the SFW's position on this. We respect all outdoorsmen's position on this. But the lions are primarily hunted by the houndsmen, and we are very passionate about the animal that we love to hunt. Some of the information that I think is getting missed here is that the houndsmen are in support of the proposal, and we are in the support of the numbers going up so that more lions are harvested, and theoretically more deer will survive. We're in support of that completely. That's what the division wants. We're merely asking, if you'll leave this a split unit, it'll give these houndsmen here an opportunity to draw a tag and have first choice, Utah's houndsmen, not out-of-staters. It'll go to a harvest objective in March. And if the division hasn't filled that quota, at that time, that quota can be filled if it's possible to be filled. And Byron says it may not make it to 100%. Hey, a lot of them don't. But we are in support of the proposal. We are in support of the tags going up so that the division reaches their goal of more deer. And we don't want that to get lost here. We're merely asking, give us the opportunity, keep it a split. It's a very minor amendment that'll help Utah's outdoorsmen, Utah's houndsmen, have first choice. That's it.
Thank you, sir.
John, what's a split unit? Define a split, how that works for the rack, please.
Boyd, ask him to define how licenses are given.
given.
Yeah, and that's going to come with this, great, I hope, with great. The split so again, limited entry, and then it turns into a,
Go back to the, I don't know where these things are. Again, the split units start out just like a regular limited entry. So November, people would go for the draw. There would be however many tags that we'd assign. It might be 20.
Are there any non-resident tags?
Oh, or is it resident? Yeah, we divide up.
So there would be resident and non-resident even in the limited entry draw?
Yes. Yeah, okay. So 10%.
Okay.
It's a percentage.
Okay.
Right. So if there was 20 overall, there'd be 18 regular and 2 limited entry. I mean, 2.
Non-resident.
Non-resident, thank you. So then if you, then once that closes in February, on February 26th, then that unit would open up as a harvest objective unit. And then anybody could buy, a harvest objective tag for any, a harvest objective tag is actually good for any unit in the state. And this is something we try to pull together numbers to figure out how many people do harvest objective on this unit versus other units. And we can't really figure that out because they're valid on any open unit. Throughout the state, so people can go here, go there, go wherever, hunt their way across Utah.
And do you have any data on how many are taken by residents compared to non-residents? I guess a question I really have, why do you think, and do you have data to support it, why do you think that no one's going to hunt on the 9-mile unit, or very few people are going to hunt on the 9-mile unit, and all of the cougars are going to be taken in the Bitter Creek unit? And why do you think that more non-residents are going to be able to hunt if it's a harvest objective all year? Do you have data, too? I want to know.
No.
I can give an opinion, but I don't have any data. Okay. Or Dan can.
Well, it is. There can be data. The 9-mile region is comprised of a lot of private property.
Daniel Davis.
Is comprised of a lot of private property.
Okay.
The terrain in that unit is very low accessibility in the seasons that we're allowed to hunt over there, primarily the winter. And the Bitter Creek unit has abundance of access. Its ease of access is, proof would be a map, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we feel the non-residents would step in is because it's open over the counter.
For the whole year, where with the split entry, it's only open for half of the time.
That is correct.
So. Is non-residents over the counter?
Yes.
Is it?
For a harvest objective, it's open to every person possible. And until they meet the quota, they will not close the unit. And so that's why we express the concern of
First serve.
The potential of harvesting 40 lions or over a 3-year period, 120 lions. Towards that more accessible unit because it's open to non-residents, outfitters from outside the state with no concern in regard for our backyard.
Of course, there's no private land down in the Book Cliffs.
Very limited. The percentage is just extremely lower.
And the tribe.
The limited hunting in Colorado. Is that what you give your Colorado people? Is that what it is?
Colorado actually is not limited. You can buy those over the counter as well.
Okay.
But the going from any unit, like Aaron stated with the Henry Mountains, you go from a limited entry unit, somewhat of a viewed as a trophy by certain people, and turn that to an open unit. The flood is gonna happen. Everybody's gonna flood to that unit to try to get the first crack at that end. And what we're also afraid of too is a misrepresentation as houndsmen. The people that come in and have disregard for the resources and the culture that we have, just to be the first one to get that animal, be the first one to harvest that trophy male, or make that trophy feed.
I guess the point I wanted to make is that one meeting was the fact that Colorado's so close. It's just right there. That's
obviously going to be a factor. It's easier access to come over here versus in the center of the state. They want to travel as far.
Correct. That answer your question.
Mm-hmm. And I can add to that. I mean, this is something that we do see. That's was part of our issue on the Wasatch Manti, where we actually wanted people to hit some of these other units. That we had them as harvest objectives, and we wanted them to hit them. But the problem is then people would tend to focus on the easily accessible units. And what we were doing, we were kind of, our management was getting a little bit out of whack because we couldn't get people to go where we wanted them to, because where they go is, of course, where it's easy and exactly what you're describing. So this is a scenario we constantly struggle with.
May I add one more thing?
Yes.
We are for opportunity. That's why the split entry offers that opportunity. We're not asking anybody to stay home. And as it was pointed out, it would be the only split season in our unit to have that opportunity to maybe hunt alone for a period of time or have that opportunity to take that animal. Whereas the rest of the region, they don't have to stay home. There's other places to go hunt. And that's our view on that.
You bet.
As far as their opinion, is the book list, I've heard the Henry Mountains, you know, analogy a couple times. Do you guys feel that it is a trophy unit on par with the Henry Mountains?
For what
like
species?
For cougar. Is it a cougar Henry Mountains equivalent?
Fellers, just a
we really can't hear you, so you want to stand up, and I will.
Okay.
I'm giving you a little leeway because we didn't go through the cards.
All right, Clay McCackney, yes. I don't count on you.
I seen you out there this year, though. You were.
Okay. Is the Book Cliffs a trophy unit with the equivalent of like a Henry Mountains? Is it a Big Tom unit? And that's what we want to know. Is it that unit? And if it is, why is it that good? And you know, you guys have made the statement a couple times that it's, you know, if you were in the Henry Mountains and wiped it out. And I just wonder if the Book Cliffs is that great of a cougar buck.
Can I answer that?
Yeah.
My name is Brad Evans. If we had the data available with the Boone and Crockett book that the state of Utah supplies, I could probably assure you that there's not, if any at all, Boone and Crockett toms that have been taken off these northern, or off this northern unit in the past, say, 5 to 6 years, where I personally can say that there are Boone and Crockett's that come out of the Booklift area each year. I personally have killed some of those lions or took clients that take those Boone and Crockett toms, and I can assure you that on a yearly basis, there probably on an average is at least one Boone and Crockett tom taken out of the area.
Just one quick comment, too. And I forget your name, I'm horrible with names. But Aaron Johnson, Houndsman Association. I hunt primarily up north. That's where I live. And for me to drive out here in the winter is harder for me to do that. But I do most of my hunting in the spring in the book place. And that's when I'm going to be here and have an opportunity to hunt and harvest as well. And I believe, and it's a personal opinion, I know Dave, that the book list is a trophy cougar unit. And I've spoken with some of my buddies. I don't want to kill a cougar up north because there's not very many. In my opinion, mismanaged. The book list is still a pretty good unit, and I'd like it to stay with that split just to see if we can harvest the numbers they want and still keep it a quality unit for housing.
Pinch?
Yes.
Can I add just a little clarification there? From the cougar management plan in the state, we don't have the designation of like premium limited entry, general season type designations for lions. I guess I wanted to give just a little bit of context. The Book Cliffs is a limited entry unit for mule deer. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago during the April rack meetings, May board meeting, you know, we had a lot of sportsmen show up, and that was a driver of this recommendation and the decision to recommend the Book Cliffs be a harvest objective unit for mountain lions versus a split unit. Because we had a lot of feedback from hunters to the point where we convened a special Book Cliffs deer committee and had a series of meetings talking about ways to address, you know, issues with mule deer in the Book Cliffs. And the number one issue that came up was the overall number of deer. Number two was buck quality, but the number one issue was the overall number of deer. Based on the collar data we got and adult doe survival and our population combined with feedback from sportsmen, you know, the division made this recommendation to change the book list from a split unit to a harvest objective unit.
and the concerns that a lot of the houndsmen have expressed, they're valid concerns, because our recommendation is designed to reduce the numbers of lions in the book list. And it would, in fact, you know, reduce the quality of the lion hunt for individuals that are interested in harvesting, you know, a trophy tom. But that is a deliberate recommendation that we made in response to concerns about the deer herd and our predator management plan criteria for the unit. So I just wanted to provide that context that the sportsman's concerns are valid, but it is a recommendation made based on concerns from deer hunters and the objectives of those we're trying to accomplish with mule deer.
Thanks, Dex. I think I'll start pulling the reins in on this just a little bit. I think we've pretty much heard,
thank you,
you know, the basics and I've got a lot of information. I did see Morgan with his hand up, though. Oh, he was scratching. It was him, all right. So anyway, appreciate it. So now we'll go to comments from the rack.
I have a question. Are any of these cougars harvested on the tribal land?
The tribe does some cougar hunting on tribal lands. They're a sovereign nation, and you know, wildlife management on tribal lands is managed by the tribe. They do harvest some lions. We don't have real good information for what they do. It's a fairly limited harvest based on talking to Roland the Cook, who leads their guiding outfitting business, but we don't have hard data from there. And these recommendations don't apply to tribal land. The state, you know, our cougar hunting is not valid on tribal lands.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
I have a question. If you go strictly harvest objective, or if you go with split and up the number of tags, aren't you going to be killing the same number of cougars?
You know, I think you're right. We could depend a little bit on weather. Usually, you know, the cougars are moving a little bit more. There's a little bit higher success those earlier storms, those first few storms of the year. But, you know, that could be debated. There's guys that do really well later in the year. Really, you know, from the division standpoint, as long as we have, you know, that increased objective to try to harvest more lions, it's not going to make a gigantic difference one way or another whether we go split or harvest objective.
Any other comments from rack members?
Yeah,
get everybody drained out, huh? Carrie?
I'm ready to move. Are you kidding me? I'm rev.
We got her wore out. We're ready to move on again.
I try harder than that.
Well, I'll accept the motion at this time.
I move to accept as presented by the Utah Houndsman Association and to make an emphasis on the inclusion of a mandatory education for cougars.
Do I hear a second?
Yeah, I will second it. I do think that is a good recommendation.
We've got a second. All in favor?
Can we get some clarification on that? Is that that?
I mean, I asked that here just a second.
that would be to maintain as a split unit.
Thank you.
I just did.
I think just what you got up and read.
Because you're taking care of everyone. In that stance, everyone is happy in that we're increasing the cougar numbers.
And if
we maintain the points, there's really no clues in that.
Objective, then. Yeah,
for everyone.
Yeah.
Do I have to let them guys in on this now?
No, just we have it. You have a motion on the table, on the floor, so you move on that, and then I can make some clarifications
after we vote.
Sure.
Once you vote,
before
it don't
we
matter
vote. Okay, I could do that too. You have to do it before we vote.
Okay.
You have to do what I tell you.
let's cover that.
What do you say? Hurry.
Mr. Chairman, point of clarification.
Yes, sir.
According to Robert's rules of order, there must be a motion before, moved and seconded, then the discussion, then the vote.
Okay.
Correct.
Yes. So what he wants to do is the cha-cha and take two steps backwards. Would you like a re-vote on the motion, or would you like to re-motion as a point of order?
No,
and did the motion pass
like
or fail?
I know exactly what the motion was. And my question is, where I'm confused, it comes spring, if the harvest is yet, if the numbers haven't been met, then they open that back up and so that the numbers are met. Is that's the clarification?
Correct.
I need. That's why they call it a split unit.
Yes. They do limited entry for a portion of the year. They assign a number. Then they'll do limited entry for a portion of the year,
And then if they haven't met that, that portion, that number, then they'll open it up, harvest objectives, so that we get that harvest. And my question would be to clarify, they said a 33% more would bring it up to what number? 20?
20.
20. Five more.
So, okay, so then to clarify what this table would look like, Oak Cliffs, Bitter Creek, split, limited entry portion, 20. Overall harvest quota, and then the 9 mile would be under a harvest objective unit, and the overall harvest quota would be 40 with the female sub quota of 20.
So everybody's, is that rack members what? Are all aware of
should
the numbers.
Should I repeat that?
Repeat that again.
Okay, I'll repeat that.
Please.
What this table would look like in the guidebook is Book Cliffs area, predator management units, these two. The first would be a split unit, which is the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek, which would have 20 limited entry permits, 20 permits with limited entry portion. Then the 9 mile would be under harvest objective unit, and with the overall quota for the area of 40 with the female subquota of 20. So people could individually take up to 20 cougars off the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek during the first portion of that hunt, and then there would be 20 more to take from that or the 9 mile during the rest of the time. Oh, the 9 mile would be open that whole time too, actually.
But would be included in the harvest objective of 40.
Yes.
Okay.
Would anybody like to read? Would you want to hear the motion again?
Carrie.
You want to hear the motion again? Carrie, would you
hear
the motion again?
You bet. I move to accept as presented by the Utah Houndsman Association and remain a split entry unit with 33% increase and make the education mandatory for cougars.
Okay.
Correct? Everyone with me?
Correct. And I will
second
it. Yes.
Any discussion? Robert? We'll take a vote then. Everybody in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? One opposed?
Two.
Three. Three
opposed?
Two.
All.
Two. Hold on. Miss it? You're kind of invisible. Two opposed?
John.
Okay, I'd like to take the opportunity because you clarify maybe what your concerns were, John.
I'm brand new, and I don't see any difference whether it stays split or whether it's harvest objective, because the same thing is going to happen. My concern is the state of Utah residents having an opportunity, and they say that, well, the out-of-staters are with the harvest objective are going to be able to do it, but there's a lot of residents that put in and don't dry out and put in and don't dry out, and maybe some of those would like an opportunity to also. And every one of them is going to hire a houndsman to go. If I go buy a tag, I'm going to get Brad or somebody to take me. I mean, I don't know that it was...
No, I don't think so either. Sir, you understand that with the split, what they would have is the opportunity on the harvest objective for anyone who wants to purchase the tag still has that opportunity following the limited entry.
I understand that, but okay. With the harvest objective, you could from the very beginning and get the better hunt. And I'm still going to hire one of these guys. I think. I mean, I don't have a dog. I'm Kylan or Brad or somebody.
Nice poodle. Take me. Be happy to go with you.
Fake.
But I'm not. I mean, it's not that.
John, maybe I can. Josh, correct me if I'm wrong. But understand, if you got a limited entry instead of the harvest objective, if you draw a tag, there's less people out in the field.
Right.
You've got more opportunity to go out. It's more of a quality hunt. I think that's the difference, isn't it, Josh? For Josh, for harvest, you have more people in there.
Limited entries, the units make more cougars. Harvest objective make less cougars.
But didn't your hunting opportunity a little better as far as the person being out
same
and
number.
Not being other houndsmen running over?
Same number.
It's kind of like general season deer and elk.
You can spend more time looking for the bigger.
Harvest objective cougars is like general season deer and elk. Over the counter tags, everybody can carry one. Deer and elk hunters, whoever wants to buy a tag can go and hunt. Just like our general season deer and elk hunt, there's hardly any deer.
Basically, the advantage is you can have a better quality hunt, look for a bigger animal. And if they don't get to get them, the animals more, killed they need, the harvest more. Objective brings them in and gets it done.
Into a
we have
feminine myself.
We have. We've already gone through. We've passed. We've done the motion. It's done.
I'm going to give one. Rob, what was your concern?
Well, with the Bookcliffs deer recovery in mind, I feel that we need to take a few more lions out of the Bookcliffs in the 9 mile area, and I don't feel this split unit is going to do that. I wanted to see it go to the harvest objective because it gave more opportunity. It gave the houndmen more days of the year to hunt, and with a quota on the lion where we shut it off when they catch that, we're not going to clean the lion out. I just feel like we needed to take a few more lions. And I don't think the split unit's going to do that.
All right. Appreciate the information. Okay. We'll move to action 11. John?
Gentlemen, thank you for coming, and I appreciate your thanks. You were all on good behavior, so that's good. Thank you.
I'll scratch your name off right now.
Next time.
Hey, don't get me started on your story.
Okay, is this great?
Ready, Professor? How many meetings did you do?
It's a short-lived chairman.
Yes.
Dale? Who? Where's our
bear of arms? That guy right there.
We've got a rowdy customer in here. The chairman would like him removed. He listens to me like everybody else, doesn't he?
Where's Dax? This might be, we're trying to come upon planet. Do you want to do a 5 minute?
I think I'm having a problem finding our presentation here.
Can I go to the last presentation?
That sounds good.
Is a bobcat?
Let me get the bobcat first.
Do your goats shouldn't be any
problem? No, let me do the bobcat.
Your goats shouldn't be any problem.
You're not supposed to change the order.
The only thing
you can if you ask
is like, oh, you're
right. I'm going to find another
quality. It could take your time. Find a little better cougar than the harvest. Everybody's out there.
I have it on a thumb drive. I've got it on a thumb drive.
And we've seen it. That's the only thing. Giving people a study and more time to find a bigger cat. If you go for a bigger cat, you've got to spend more time.
There's a difference.
Make it up from the other end.
There's a difference between 20 and 40. Because if they combine it with 9 mile, there's a chance that they'll kill 40 lions in the book. And that's what we're scared of. We agree with up in the 9 mile.
I think it's highly unlikely. I think you're concerned. I think it's highly unlikely.
Yeah.
Huh?
Not including you.
Oh, sorry.
Since I started sitting in all these safety meetings, I started crying.
I just thought
that was a good idea. Now he's a royalty. Let everybody out there
If we've all had the opportunity to review it, is there anyone that wants to talk on permits? Can we do that? I can't imagine why not. You're also welcome to use my iPad.
Let's do that. Our chairman has a recommendation here that we'd like to do.
John, how about just doing the hard copies with us?
Okay. Do you have the hard copies?
We didn't think the ones left counted, did they?
Sure.
Because they were gone.
So it looks like it is a hazard in your offspring.
If all these guys are not going to be an issue, but I didn't know.
Sorry. Right click on your desktop.
I'll just say we
need to talk about your personalization or your property or your store, right?
Thank you, Gail.
We had to do discussions before.
Maybe.
This might get us home before
midnight. Do you remember what it was named?
Oh, gosh. We were a little large. It has to be in about, I think, by 10.
No, tomorrow morning.
So I was going to say, maybe tomorrow morning I'll have large from Foundry.
Yeah, I'll go to the post.
Because when I read through all the, as I actually started skimming the emails, I basically would look at them because they're in the first email and the first email I get. So,
they got together
over there. Yeah, well,
that's about the greatest thing ever. Triplet? Is that what that is?
Three cubs, right?
He's got two of them.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
There it is.
Makes you want to go sit right there with my high power camera. That poor woman.
Will the RAC members want to go ahead with the hard copies?
Please.
Continue on. Will I get this one after tonight? Because I'm retired after tonight.
We don't know that you are.
Floyd got one. This is mine. I'm taking this one. I'm taking this home with me. They give Floyd the last gap on this one.
That's what you said.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, we're ready to go.
Okay, good. John, you got the floor, sir.
Thank you. It's nice to see you all again. For better recommendations, this one's a lot simpler. We'll get done with this a little bit faster. It's a lot simpler. But just some basic things in the outline of it, some clarifications, information on beaver issues, and just terms and things. Then I've got the specific fur bearer recommendations, and then we'll go on into bobcats and have that lumped in here at the same time, too. Bobcats are a yearly thing. Beaver, simple rule wording clarification. We're adding some nuisance language into the rule where people, it's called depredation for beaver, and then it talks about damage. The problem is with that is beavers can be a nuisance, be a problem before they actually cause damage. You're going to want to be able to remove them before they clog the culvert and kill trees or something like that. So it's just a real simple little word just to help guide people. That's all. Another wording clarification, we do have areas that are closed to beaver and mink trapping, and the way it says trapping in the guidebook, and some people have been interpreting that to mean, oh, then I can still shoot them or do whatever. So we just made it take, or proposing take, or some version of take, so it's a little clearer that we don't want animals removed, actually. Now, here's another thing of more importance to the southern region. There's a couple irrigation districts where they've had historic issues, and we understand that. We want to help them as best we can and try to target trappers down onto those areas to see if we can get beaver trappers there to do some work. So we're recommending putting into the guidebook two paragraphs that say, here's two areas in Garfield County and Kane County where if you're interested in trapping beaver, call these water masters up and see if you can go down there and help them out. So just to nod to the issues that beavers cause as well. There's some other things more up in the northern areas, northern regions, where there's additional areas closed to take. You've got in your packet, you've got some more information about why these are, but Box Elder, Emery, Cache, Fish County, Summit County, the drainages are listed, and all of these are for similar reasons. That is, there's either an ongoing research project, there's a demonstration project, or some kind of a restoration project happening up there. So we want to close those for that reason. At least for the time being, and these would be added to the guidebook. Fur bearer seasons, now just to go into the nuts and bolts of things. Beaver and mink, consistent with previous years, you're going to see this a lot. All I do is I adjust the dates to, so we can't start on a Sunday or anything, so seasons are all more or less the same length as they have been, and September 8th, September 28th, April 7th for these guys. Badger, gray fox, etc. Again, consistent with previous years. No big change in management, September 28th to February 2nd. Martin, again, consistent with previous years, September 28th to February 2nd. Otter, this is something that we've been wanting to open up otter. We'd really like to establish an otter season at some point here. We're working on, I need to have a better population monitoring system, and I don't have that quite yet. So we're working with BYU and some genetic stuff and trying to be able to do this better. Hopefully in the next couple of years we will, and we'll be able to have an otter harvest. But for right now, at least a limited otter harvest. For right now, we're not recommending any though. That's the general fur bearers. Now to zoom in on bobcats. This will be similar to what I presented last year. This bobcat also has a plan with performance targets and strategies. These are the performance targets. We're looking at percent young, percent adult survival, percent females, and set days per bobcat, which essentially is a catch per unit effort. How many traps do people have to set out before they capture one? And there's the historic ranges that we want to fall into. then the plan, if we look at the last couple of years, the percent juvenile, that is, well, let's focus on the percent survival and percent female, the two middle ones first, because they fall right into where the target is. So two of our indicators, two of our targets are right where we want them to be. The percent juveniles are a little lower than what the target wants to be, but it's gone up from 31 to 35 and 35 again. There's a bit of a trend towards upward. Set days for bobcat is moving down towards where it's higher than we want it to be, but it's moving down in the right direction as well. So the guidance from the plan says that if any two targets are outside of the range, we'd adjust the number of tags per individual. However, it also says to keep the number of tags consistent with previous year, the variables are moving towards targets. So we have one of these fairly typical things in wildlife management where two of the things are in range, two of them are out of range. But since everything, last year we made the same recommendation, since everything's trending in the right place, there's no real reason to do a big tweak in the system. What we're recommending is consistency again with the previous year. So this will be a couple of years in a row where we've recommended the maximum number of permits at 4,600 and a limit of 3 permits per individual and the season from November 27th to February 2nd, again, consistent with what we had seen before. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Any questions from the back member? Any questions from the public? Okay, I believe we'll go to comments. Kent, did you want to make a comment again?
Yes, sir. Again, Kent, Utah Trappers Association. We support the amendment or the program that's submitted by the Fish and Game and would ask their RAC to do the same. Thank you.
Thanks, Kent. Any comments from the RAC board? I'll entertain a motion at this time.
Mitch.
What? Did I miss somebody?
Yes. I had those three the last time.
Oh, that's right. Mm. 10, 11, and 12.
I'll be quick. Byron Bateman, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. We support the division's recommendation for the Fur Bear Proclamation. So, and we support the trappers and what they've been doing with the division to make sure this is a good program. So thank you.
Byron, I apologize.
No problem.
It's his fault.
When you got somebody to blame for it.
Where was we?
Any comments from the RAC?
Nope.
So I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve the just the way the division set forth.
Any discussion on the motion?
I'll second.
I second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Guy, you're up and on the floor.
Scotch?
This is what I go for.
We'll get him a new one.
My name is Dustin Shively. I'm a wildlife biologist down in the southern region. I cover Garfield and Kane counties. And in my district, I cover Mount Zeppelin, and I'm here to talk about the mountain goat plan for that unit. Justin Shan will also speak to the LaSalle plan as well. Kind of an outline for the talk here is just kind of go over some broad goals of what we include in our in most all of our big game management plans for individual units. Then I'll also talk about some of the habitat modeling we've done. And then we'll go over some of the specifics for both the Dutton and then the LaSalle's, including the population habitat objectives and issues and concerns and the strategies to meet those. Again, here's some broad statements, again, that we include in most of our year plans. Our goals, you know, in managing the mountain goats is going to be managed for a population of healthy animals capable of providing a broad range of recreational opportunities, including hunting and viewing. Then we want to maintain these populations at sustainable levels within the carrying capacity or the habitat available to support them. And then also just to balance all the impacts goats may have, including other public interests and private property rights and local economies. So since these are two brand new units that we were looking at managing mountain goats on, in order to start the process, we wanted to model the habitats to predict where they would be. And in order to do that, we used a GIS-based model that was developed by Gross et al. In 2002, where they applied a 258-meter buffer around all slopes that were greater than 30 degrees or better. And they did this since goats are so highly associated with escape terrain. They found that buffer, when applied to those slopes, would accurately classify about 87% of mountain goat habitat. The one downside to that model is it doesn't have a specific elevational component to it. And so we ran it at several different levels, but when we did it off of what we are current goat units, we found that 9,000 feet kind of best represented it. And so in order to be standard across the state, we ran it at 9,000 feet. On the Mount Dutton unit specifically, again, above 9,000 feet, we found that there's about 74 square miles of habitat that fit within those parameters of the model. And since Mount Dutton is kind of limited by high elevation habitat, the highest place on the Dutton is just over 11,000 feet. We were going to start with a smaller population, like 125, which is similar to some of the other smaller goat units in the state. And if we were to manage for 125 goats across the unit, we'd have 1.7 goats per square mile. On the LaSalle's, just to show above 9,000 feet, there are 62 square miles, and there's a lot more high elevation habitat there. It gets well over 12,000 feet, and we were looking at managing for 200 goats there, and above 9,000 feet, the density would be 3.2 per square mile. Just to show worst case scenario, if they all stayed in the very upper reaches of the mountains up there, it would be about 4.9 goats per square mile above 10,000 feet. And just to give you a comparison, these are densities, population objectives, and densities across the state for our established goat units. The three last rows there kind of show depth in the cells, but generally, our goats per square mile in the state, we average about 5 goats per square mile. And so on the Dutton, again, just to highlight that again, at 125, we'll be at 1.7. And LaSalle's, we suspect 3.2. But worst case scenario would be right about the average of what we're running in the rest of the state. Land ownership for Mount Dutton is 100% administered by the Forest Service. On the LaSalle, it's a pretty similar story there. 84% is Forest Service, or 7% private, and 9% state lands. To give you a background on Mount Dutton specifically, goats are already there. They're not high number, but they are there. We have had documented goats coming over, we suspect from the adjacent Cheshire Mountain Range, since at least the early 2000s, but we do have anecdotal reports before that as well. In 2011, we were getting frequent sightings of mountain goats, and it was starting to become more than just individuals, smaller groups. And so at that point, we recognized the need to start the process of developing a management plan. We contacted the Forest Service, and I've been working with them here for the last couple of years and kind of addressing some of their concerns and what it would take to start a new unit on the Dutton. And in 2012, or July of last year and February of this year, I was out there doing other surveys and found actually this nanny in this picture with two kids. And so we documented that the goats that are on Denton are starting to breed. And that kind of solidifies the need for a management plan for at least the ones that are there, and then also look for the future and transplanting to some to augment them. Also in February 2013 here, earlier this year, we began working with Garfield County and the Forest Service, and together we kind of, the county felt more comfortable if they had a little bit more input from the local public, and so we held an open house in Panguitch on June 20th of this year. We had 18 people attend that open house where we received 17 written comments. Of those comments, there was 13 in support, 4 did not support it. 10 of the comments included statements that were supportive of goats for viewing purposes. 8 of those were for hunting. The 4 that were not in support of the goat management plan were concerned about impacts to ranching. They're also concerned about some of the elk issues that we have on the Denton. And then also we had 6 comments that had statements that felt the goats would have minimal impact on other wildlife species in the area and habitat and livestock. And so again, in working with the county and the Forest Service, we went through all the issues and concerns and kind of identified those in the unit plan. It's very similar to the statewide plan and pretty much the same topics. I mean, it's native status. Again, the habitat modeling, competition and disease issues and concerns, non-consumptive use and sensitive species, primarily looking at different plant species, and predation. So all those are identified in the Denton unit plan. But just to highlight the habitat concerns and some of the things that go on with that, since that's one of the bigger concerns when you're looking at starting a new unit for a big game species. The main story on Mount Denton is in 2002 we had the Sandy Fire, which burned 78,000 acres, and that greatly improved forage production. And aside from the riparian areas, the unit looks in pretty good shape. And so we don't have a specific habitat project we would really like to focus on for goats specifically, and so our strategy is just going to continue to support this Forest Service and all their management plans, including their travel management plans and timber management, those types of things. Sensitive species, that's usually another good issue to make sure we address, and as we did that, we found that Rideberg's milk vetch exists on Mount Denton. This is a species that at one time was listed as threatened, but it was delisted in the 80s. Since it's been found in good numbers on all adjacent mountain ranges around Mount Denton. So it's been delisted. It's not a sensitive species on the Dixie National Forest at this time, but it's something that we'll keep an eye on just because it does exist there in goat habitat. Strategies, as always, we coordinate with our land management agencies pretty closely on all aspects of it, and the vegetative monitoring, we just work on with them on setting up transects and kind of documenting any impacts goat would have to the habitat. We'd also commit to putting one of our division range trend transects out there. These would be read every 5 years. So as a whole, for Mount Denton, what we'd be looking again, 125 goats. Again, this may be an optimistic number because it's, you know, kind of limited in high elevation habitat, but it's definitely got the ruggedness that goats require. So that's where we're going to, what we're proposing to start with on the unit. Our habitat strategies and goals, again, just always coordinating with the Forest Service on monitoring and supporting them in the restoration projects and the livestock grazing plans. And then when it's determined that we can have a hunt on Mount Denton, we'll just follow the statewide plan, which was just recently passed, and make recommendations consistent with that plan, which is to harvest 5 to 15% of the population annually, and then maintain a 90% harvest success rate. We'd also look to promote goat viewing opportunities as a non-consumptive part of goat management. It's a very popular event that we hold on the Teshers. We have over 100 people come to that, and so we'd like to just extend that into Garfield County on Mount Denton as well. I'm going to let Justin Shannon know, talk about Los Alamos.
My name is Justin Shannon. I'm the wildlife manager for the Southeast region, and I'm going to present the LaSalle portion of this. On the LaSalles, we want to manage for 200 animals, and we want to establish vegetative monitoring sites prior to release, and then add new sites post-release in areas that are going to be used by mountain goats. A lot of this has already been done. We've done repeat photography, transects similar to what they do on the Ashley, on the goats, on the Uintas, and our range trend is going to meet with the Forest Service in a week and a half, and we're going to set up several more of these permanent range transects. We also want to monitor mountain goat human conflicts and promote viewing opportunities and continue to support regulated livestock grazing. Similar to what they did on the Dutton, the division's been, the Southeast region's been working with the Forest Service and approached them and told them something we were considering and asked for issues and concerns. And we also held an open house down in Moab. It was well attended. We had 38 people show up. There were more people in support than those against. And there was a lot in the middle, too, that we just had good discussion and dialogue and kind of Q&A on mountain goats and the LaSalles. Some of the things that came out were similar issues that have already been presented. Some of the highlight ones were sensitive and endemic plants that are found on the Los Alamos. There's a research natural area, which is about 3 square miles on the Los Alamos as well, and that was an issue. And then there's a lot of recreation down there. It's just adjacent Moab there. So there were concerns on what impacts there would be on recreation, what restrictions we'd recommend. So to address the population strategies for an initial release, we'd want to release 20 to 40 animals on the north block near Beaver Basin. For monitoring, we would monitor similar to our other big game species, look at survival rates, distribution, etc. And these animals are going to be radio collared at release, and they will be on the Dutton as well. Harvest, want to use this as a tool to keep the population at or below 200 animals. And if predation becomes a limiting factor, we can certainly do predator control to get the population established. For habitat strategies, for monitoring, the Division and Forest Service have worked well together on this, and we're in the process of developing a habitat and vegetative monitoring plan that is going to be discussed annually. This is nothing new. We meet with our forest every year and go over our big game populations and habitat and habitat projects, and so this would be a process. This would be another species that we involve in that. And this plan is going to address how we work together on monitoring a sense of the plants and mountain goat use in the RNA. For range conflicts, we want to use harvest strategies to reduce or alter mountain goat distribution if impacts are observed, and support potential projects and respond to depredation issues if they occur. And finally, for recreation, want to investigate human-goat interactions. This is a big one for the area down there. We're recommending no restrictions to the Forest Service on current recreational activities. We want to respect and be sensitive to the uses that already exist on this mountain, so there would be nothing along those lines. And then finally, provide public viewing and educational opportunities, as they do in other parts of the state. So the big question that we get often is, why do we want mountain goats on the LaSalles, and why are we writing a plan for this? On the Dutton, it makes sense. You already have a breeding population of goats there, so how are we going to manage them? But for the LaSalles, it's different, because we would introduce mountain goats to this area. And some of the reasons we have listed here, they have the characteristics of suitable mountain goat habitat, similar to other units in the state, in the neighboring state in Colorado. If you think of where Moab is in Utah, you can draw a big horseshoe along the mountain goat populations along Colorado, up around the Uintas, and then down the Wasatch Front. And so they're kind of surrounded by mountain goats already, mountain goat populations. So additionally, the goat transplants in Utah, we haven't documented changes in plant species composition. Had mountain goats in the state since the 60s. And the Ashley National Forest, with their monitoring efforts, they haven't shown changes in plant species composition or ground cover, and they've actually written us letters saying that there's no negative trends associated with their habitat and the presence of mountain goats. We also want to increase hunting and viewing opportunities. When you look at mountain goat hunting in the state, we have 8,000 applicants that apply annually, and we issue roughly 175 tags. And so we've been asked if we can expand hunting opportunities, we ought to do it. And so this is part of that proposal. And finally, these habitats on the LaSalle's, they were historically occupied by bighorn sheep. In the 1940s and 50s, the Forest Service and USGS reported sightings of mountain goats at high elevations, well over 12,000 feet. The USGS did, but unfortunately, those bighorn populations were extirpated. They're no longer there. You can't find bighorns at those elevations on that unit. And so, we're not proposing to restore bighorn sheep. As much as I love bighorn sheep and I'm a bighorn guy, I would love to do it. But there's disease risk. There's still domestic sheep grazing on that unit. We want to be sensitive to the agricultural uses that are already there, and so we don't want to create that threat. And so we want to use mountain goats as a surrogate to restore a native ungulate to these high elevation areas on the LaSalle's. And in our research, we found a lot of documentation that bighorn and mountain goats have high resource overlap, meaning their diets are very similar and they use the same habitat. So we felt like it would be a very good surrogate to fill that niche that's left by the extirpation of bighorn sheep. So. With that, thank you.
Thanks, Dustin.
Yep.
Any questions from the RAC committee? Any questions from our public? Okay, we've got some comment cards. Byron? Get you right on top.
Byron Bateman, Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. I just want to commend the division for taking lead in this to bring forth this transplant onto LaSalle's and also for the augmentation on the Dutton to increase, you know, opportunity for all people in the state of Utah, because populations we have right now starting in the, you know, Willard Peak in the north, going all the way down to the south to the Beavers Mountains, the Tushers and stuff right now. There's a lot of people just love to get out and hike and watch and see these mountain goats and stuff like that. And we don't have any impacts or very minimal impacts with grazers and livestock operators, and we're willing to work whatever we have to do to make it work with livestock operators, you know, for these two additional units down there. But mountain goats is one of our greatest success stories we've had here in the state. We just want to see this continue, that we become more and more recognized for the quality of wildlife we have in the state. All the other states around us, their populations of different wildlife, especially the deer and elk and other populations, have been really diminished over the years and stuff like that. And we've been fortunate. We've been able to maintain and grow our populations of deer and elk and other species like bighorn sheep and mountain goats in the state of Utah. So we're in 110% support of the division's recommendation to transplant and augment these two populations to Mountain Dutton and to the south. We just ask you to do the same. Thank you.
Thanks, Byron. Kent?
I'm Kent Bowden, sportsman. I'd just like to echo what Byron has stated to the RAC. Any time that we have the opportunity for an augmentation or a transplant should be applauded. And I commend the Fish and Game also for the initiative and the work in doing that. And I support them 100% and would ask this RAC to do the same. Thank you.
Thanks, Kent. Garrick? Mr. Hall?
Thank you. I'm Garrick Hall. I'm here representing the Utah Farm Bureau. Of course, we are always concerned with mountain goats and the potential for conflict with domesticated livestock. We hope, and from the presentation, they say there's not going to be those conflicts, and we hope there are not, but history has shown that those things can exist. My understanding, the Southern RAC recommended that a mountain goat committee be formed to watch the goats on Mount Dutton, similar to the bison committee down on the Henrys. And I would recommend that something similar be recommended by this RAC, just to watch that population of mountain goats, make sure that we stay within the parameters that are set, and that they stay in the area that they're supposed to be in, so that we don't have those conflicts with the grazers that are up there, the sheep and cattle. We're not opposed to the animals being there, but we want to make sure that they stay within the parameters that have been discussed. We've seen, you know, examples in the past of animals being transplanted, and it's just going to be a small population, and several years down the road we've got a problem because it's grown and become something it was never intended to be. So the presentation, we talked about monitoring those, and the farmer would encourage that we monitor that closely and make sure that stays within the parameters that we want it to be in. So thank you.
Gary, who put this committee together?
You know,
if it's like the Bison Committee, which is what he's recommended, it would be the division, and they would pull together landowners and sportsmen. That's what they've done in the past, and they meet annually to go over any of the issues, anything, any of the concerns, to try to make sure that those are addressed. And they go back and forth on, you know, what needs to be done, what they think needs to be done. Isn't that right?
I think that, you know, the main essence of what we want to see is a group that can evaluate this yearly and make adjustments yearly as needed, rather than wait and say, well, we'll evaluate it in 3 years or in 5 years or whatever. We want to be right on top of it every year and make sure that we keep that population within the parameters that are adequate. You know, our fear is that we'll get too many animals and they'll start to move down the mountain, and that's when we'll come into problems. We want a group that can watch that closely and can adapt and adjust as needed.
So can I ask you a question? How's the committee worked on the hen race with the buffalo?
You know,
has it been effective at all?
All I know is I don't cover that area for Farm Bureau, so I don't work with them directly. I know John Keeter, who's our regional manager in that area, thinks that's an effective committee, but I don't have any personal experience with it.
I do.
I think maybe Byron could maybe answer your question.
Okay. I'm on that committee.
Because I know there's been quite a concern about the increase in numbers and stuff.
It's,
you're not prejudiced, are you?
No. I believe in multiple use. And that's how the Forest Service is supposed to manage and the BLM, so multiple use. But actually, the Bison Committee is down there right now. We're doing our annual survey. I was scheduled to go down there yesterday, and today we're doing our flights and monitoring. We got collars on the bison down there so we can track their, you know, the population. If we don't find them all, then we can go back and fly until we found all the bison so we can, you know, verify the counts. But we've worked very good hand-in-hand with the permittees and stuff down there on the mountain. We've had our moments and our times. We meet in low at high noon in the courthouse. I mean, that tells you. And the sheriff's office is right next door. But we work together really well, and we've come a long ways from where we started out with that committee and stuff like that. And we've all learned a lot of different information as to how everything interacts down there on the mountain as far as, you know, the cattle and the bison and everything else. So it is a good working relationship between, you know, different users of the, you know, the resource. So something like that would be, you know, we would totally, you know, welcome something like that to go along with this, just to get more information. One other thing, all these goats will have radio collars on when they're released. Some will be GPS collars. You know, they can get, you know, downloads and stuff on those. Others will be just VHF collars. But they, you know, they're all going to have a collar on. So if there is a problem, we can go in and remove specific animals or anything like that. So it's kind of unique, and we're just starting with a small population, you know, going forward too. So. But I think anytime we can work together and with different committees like that, it's just a great opportunity, learning experience for everybody.
Byron, I just maybe just expand a little bit on what you said. I'll fast forward to the comment. Without these committees, as an agriculture person, you have problems. When you have these committees, the problems are solved usually before they fester. These committees are a good deal. They work. They solve problems.
They do. That's the beauty of it.
And that's from the agriculture view of it, because they're involved, they solve problems. Thanks, Byron.
All right, thank you.
And I believe we got Dave Olson.
Yes.
Do you represent?
Dave sent me, Mr. Chairman, a letter of he's representing himself. He wants that to make sure that that's known. He's representing himself. He was in favor of the military installation permit, which we already voted for or voted on and was accepted. Then he's also the Mountain Goat release proposal for both the Dutton and the LaSalle will provide a great new resource for public recreation and expansion of one of the West's unique wildlife icons. He's reviewed the DWR management plan associated with both of these units and fully supports these and hopes that the division will as well. And basically that's it. There's more to it, but he's asking the RAC to support the division's recommendation on the GOAT plan.
Has anybody got any questions for Mr. Olson?
I have a question. How many dollars per animal will they spend?
To move them?
For the first...
To capture and transplant.
In the first 4 years, collar, monitor, and transplant.
I can't go gave those numbers last night. Do you remember?
It was about $1,000 per animal for capture and radio collaring. About $200-$300 per call for the radio collars, $250, and about $750 or something for capture. So it's about $1,000 per animal to capture and radio collar. The transplant's done quite easy. They put in boxes that they moved in horse trailers. It's very inexpensive that way. The follow-up flights to follow up on the radio collars. I don't remember exactly. It's about $200 per hour anyway, and 5-6 hours per flight. At least once a month anyway to keep track of those animals. What did you come up with for a rough total on that? It was going to be about $35,000, all of which was going to come from conservation permit money to fund those. Byron, may again, one more one coming up.
Go ahead, Byron.
Well, we put up the money to cover it, so. Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, you know, the money we raise off conservation permits, we donated 100% of that money back to be used for this transplant. So, these costs are covered.
Any other questions? Murat? Comments from Murat? Okay, we'll entertain a motion at this time.
Mr. Chair, if I may, for clarity for the board, I know it's one presentation. It really is two separate action items. If you guys would like to combine them into one action item, both that way, that's fine. But in the other acts, they have separated it out and done one for the done, one for the LaSalle, for clarity.
Does anyone want to split them now?
I'll make a motion. I'll make a motion that we approve as presented as the two separate units, as the LaSalle and the Mountain Dutton. We go with the way the division is presented.
A second motion.
Maybe a substitute motion. That's in order.
Well, let's have some discussion on the motion.
I'd just like to make the same motion and incorporate the Farm Bureau recommendation that a committee be established to monitor those.
So this is an amendment to the motion.
Just substitute motion.
Substitute motion. Okay.
I'll second that.
Did we all get that? Did everybody understand that?
Mm-hmm. So are we combining these motions away?
And he amended the motion to have the DWR put this committee together.
I think that we have to vote on the original motion, and then we have to either fail that or pass that.
No, the substitute. You just vote on the substitute motion. If it passed, the first one goes away. Just goes away.
Well, that's when we had a discussion.
If you vote on the second, just vote on the second, and then that takes the place of the original.
Who's having the second motion?
So we will take a motion. On the substitute.
Yeah.
We'll take a vote on the substitute motion at this time.
Okay. Any discussion?
What was the motion?
Do we support the Fish and Game, DWR's recommendation on Mount Dutton and the LaSalle's, and incorporate the recommendation from the Farm Bureau that a committee be established in those local areas?
On the Dutton or the LaSalle's as well?
On both. On both.
When we met with the Forest Service on our plan, they didn't think the permittees would have much issue with it because the grazing allotments are quite a bit lower on the Dutton there. So.
Okay, this time we'll take a vote then. All in favor?
Aye.
One, two, three. Yeah.
Hold them up high. Let's get a good look here.
Okay.
All opposed?
One opposed.
Motion passes.
Wait.
Did you abstain or?
I'm abstaining, yep.
What?
I'm abstaining.
Okay, thank you.
Well, in the past, we've asked a reason. I've done it tonight.
Yeah, the fourth.
Is that? Yes. Does it bother you? Do you want to give us a reason? So we can enlighten us a little bit.
The Forest Service is taking the position of supporting the plan as presented to the Mount Dutton against introduction of goats into LaSalle at this point.
They read the letter. The chairman of the RAC, which is a Forest Service employee, read the letter from the Forest Service.
Yes.
No position either way on the LaSalle.
So no position.
No position.
It's not what I read from the Forest Supervisor for the Mantell South.
I have a copy of the letter if you'd like me to read it.
I've got a copy right here myself. So.
It'd help us out a little bit. You might want to bring them comments in a little earlier in the comment period. We didn't realize you had those reservations. So it had helped us if you brought them in just a little bit earlier before we motioned and voted. Appreciate it. That's why we asked this, to find out what's up.
Mitch.
Yeah.
Yes.
You got to drive a vote. You had one vote, you had two motions. I believe you should have one vote on both each motion. So you should have two votes. Now, for instance, Dan, he may have voted for on the Dutton and against on the South. You've got two motions on the table. You got to take two votes.
But we started out combining, and Dan never said anything.
The original motion.
You still had two motions. I don't care what Dan said.
And I thought the substitute took the place of the first motion, but it didn't.
Both motions included both action items.
I agree. Both motions included both action items. Maybe we should have split the vote, split the motion.
Well, I think you should have.
Well, that's how it was done in other regions. I thought I heard.
To make a change, because this goes into the record, you know.
It's done. Sentence. You're done.
Shame on us.
I did.
You know, you're pretty brazen public.
I did.
We can expedite the process.
Anyone, tell everybody we appreciate you for coming. We've got a little extra business we've got to do tonight as committee, so if you want me to miss the alleyway, you're going to have to wait for a little while.
Y'all did good, thank you.
Okay, I do need a break.
Hang on. Oh, you got to go?
Yes.
All right.
Well, just for a couple minutes, probably get.
All right.
I'd get all the information. I'd write me. You guys get that done and get it down next. You'll bring our morning.
Thanks. We're going to take a really quick break in case we need to take care of something. And then I need everybody to come back.
Yeah.
or you can just wait here. But we, Andrea had to leave for just a second, so we'll wait until she gets back here.
If she leaves, we'll nominate her.
Yep.
Yeah, why don't you go over and take a picture of each person?
Why?
We got the votes to put in there.
Because
I don't know. Or,
I don't know. He does have a reason for
it. You kind of do, actually.
I don't. That's what told him last meeting. I told him that he's biased.
We got the votes.
Try it.
For the what?
I'm the best weasel in the world.
I'm pretty sure
I've been warned against letting people put my picture on the internet.
I know that.
I can't wait.
It's for my board.
Oh, dartboard?
No.
So I can come out and
go. Oh, yeah.
I really like a mug with my own face on it for Christmas. And on the opposite side, I want Rod.
Yeah, but you're right. You're a politician.
That'd be great. If I t-shirt for Christmas, would be great. That'd be excellent.
You're wanting a group picture, right?
That's interesting.
We're going to get a lot closer.
For, I think, okay.
Yeah.
So we expedited and do them both at the same time.
I think the chairman should start having some of the public thrown out of here when we start causing trouble.
Stay used to be there.
No, he's not.
Not now.
He's retired.
Ah, okay. He's done. He's done.
Did Kirk get put on?
Kirk's on.
Jenny got put on.
I'm always teasing
the governor's office.
You know, it's cold in here.
Not bad.
You guys take your trouble.
Hey, when you're from governor, you're doing this.
I know.
With our change in our chairman, with our chairman going to the wildlife board, that's necessitated us, as we knew back when we voted for that, to get a new chairman and a vice chair. I'm going to let the current vice chair decide how he wants to handle that or run it past the group to see how you guys want to handle it. What's your pleasure?
Well, I guess that we're going to vote again. Basically, we just take nominations for, I would think, a new president to begin with.
New chair, yeah. You can chair. You can take nominations. You can vote. You can whatever you want to do.
I don't see a need for discussion or questions.
Okay.
Unless he comes in play, then I got a lot of questions.
Okay. I'm not, but I'd nominate Mitch.
At this time, I'll entertain nominations.
Nominations.
Okay, I'll start out. So I would like to nominate Wayne McAllister as our new chairman.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second it. So I would like to ask if Wayne McAllister wants to be the chairman.
I would serve as chairman if he'd be.
Okay.
Is that your answer?
I don't think that was a very solid answer. There's no confidence behind that whatsoever, but I think it's a fair question. Yeah. Whether or not he wants to.
He just answered.
Okay.
And we have a second here, Andrea.
Any more? I mean,
do we have any other motions for people?
Well, we had Mitch.
No, that was
second. I want to nominate Rod. Yes, I really want someone to second it.
You know, I don't know Wayne very well, but I know Joe Batty there, and it sounds like he knows Robert's rules pretty good.
I agree. Mr. Chairman, I respectfully decline the nomination.
All right.
Well, maybe we should have a little comment. I've talked to Wayne. Wayne's been on the board. Different people I've talked to thought he'd do an excellent job. I do. I think anybody here would do a good job. So we can entertain motions on anybody. You know, I've worked with Wayne, know Wayne a little more than I do. Knew. I've even talked to Rod and guys about anybody do a good job. Carrie would do a good job. But I've worked with Wayne more than I do with anybody around. We do a lot of stuff together, so that's why I nominate him, and he said he would do it.
And he's a hunter, so...
But nominations aren't closed.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I move that we suspend the rules and put Wayne in by acclamation.
All right, Mr. Batty, I'll expand the rules again, too. I move that Wayne in as chairman and Andrea Merrill as vice chair.
Andrea Merrill declines. I have recently accepted a position in another committee that I am on that... actually, secretary, so I have to keep minutes and prepare minutes.
You're
so
sleep your eye, aren't you?
So I just don't
let's
see
go
that
back
I have
original. Time. Let's go back. Let's go back. I'll tell you what, maybe we'll
I can't believe they haven't put me in his chair so I keep my mouth shut during these meetings. I couldn't even vote if that was the case. I just have to sit there and listen.
She would make some good meetings now. Let's go back. Well, let's we got one. Well, we got Wayne Mason for Wayne. It's been seconded. There is more. I move the nomination cease.
I'll second it.
Okay. We get a vote, the nomination cease. And we go, I'm not doing this right. Well, I'd like to take, how do you vote? We vote by hand or private ballot? Well, he's in.
Don't we have to vote on the motion?
All in favor, Wayne, say aye.
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 Okay.
And I will nominate Carrie for the vice chair.
Okay, is there a second on that?
I'll second it.
Is there any others that we want to throw in the hat?
Don't stop now.
Anybody going to close that nomination?
Do you want that, Carrie?
That'd be great.
Do you want that, Carrie?
That. You bet. Okay. Mostly because my, you know, the end result would be to move to the Wildlife Board. And I think whoever moves in his chair should anticipate going to the Wildlife Board in the future. Just saying, person down the chute. And I'm right behind you.
What we find, Kay, the problem is our jobs and our work restraints.
Absolutely.
That's the problem.
Oh, I hear you.
That's the problem. And that's why a good vice chair should probably split the meetings, and then they know what's going on, and it makes for a good chairman. You even get a good gal.
I've dreamed of something to meet somebody with for my whole life.
Even on my retirement, do I get this gal?
Care.
Yes.
Are we good then? Close nominations. All in favor of Carrie?
Aye.
Okay, next thing. We got to have our summer barbecue and get. Oh. We have so many. We have to have our summer barbecue, get together, and do something with each other here. So we're looking probably, Gail, September? Okay.
Do you have a calendar? Do you can give us some weeks? We're probably thinking week three, Wednesday.
Yeah. The first of the month, end of the month.
Middle. Is that all right? Middle?
So like a Wednesday, the... Or how about Thursday the 19th, maybe?
Okay, Thursdays. Everybody has meetings on Thursdays.
Do they?
It's Farm Bureau.
Okay.
Everybody does.
I think Tuesday.
Tuesday the 17th?
That would work.
That is my birthday.
That is your birthday.
We'll see.
I will
happy birthday.
Sing we'll have
a big birthday party for you.
Okay, you know,
fantastic.
Last year we let somebody get away without the offered to cater, and then
I will cater on Tuesday the 17th. I will cater the best Dutch I've ever had. How many people should I count on?
Wait, let me get to that date. Tuesday?
You got nothing, boy. You don't do anything. Don't even pretend.
Randy Durth and Rod Morrison have hunts going on that week.
Oh, that's what he said. Trevor Mills Hunt.
Yeah, I got a hunt going on that week.
You did not. No kidding?
That's my week.
Congrats. That's awesome.
No, he's a medical. He's a surgeon.
Okay, so what? Jason, you got to go with them for another day.
No, he's in medical.
The 10th?
Oh, I thought.
Carrie's in charge of catering.
Yeah, she's going to feed us all. Well, we're
should have made me the chair, sucker.
Let's get Clint back tomorrow.
What did he come up with that name?
The 10th is a Tuesday, the 24th is a Tuesday.
If you need a barbecue, if you need some barbecue, Clint or Samson's.
September 24th. Is that good or 10th?
Congratulations.
10th is better for me.
10th's better?
10th is better for me.
10th, all right.
September 10th.
September 10th.
Is
that,
is that what they said? Okay, John and I were talking tonight. Okay, September 10th.
And it's a Tuesday?
10th Tuesday.
Yes.
First weekend. I think that works.
What time?
Well, probably
6-ish.
Six thirty. We'll get you. We'll get that information out. We'll send it out to you. And mark off on your calendars the 10th, and we'll have a barbecue and
yeah, really good food.
We'll
yeah.
have
every year.
Doc Clint in the barbecue. We'll make sure of that.
Okay.
Doc Clint. Oh, I don't know. We'll do something here. We'll carry. We'll set it up and help us, and we'll help her. We'll get it all taken care of. And
where are you going to have
Randy, can we have it at your place?
Yep.
Okay. So it'll be at Randy Durth's place.
Which is?
Somewhere. We'll get that back to you. We'll get everything all put together.
You guys know where Dale Brady lives?
Yeah.
Just one.
Or are you up by?
I'm just a house between. There's oh, Dr. Nilsson's and then me. I'm right on the corner there.
Jeff knows, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he knows where it's at.
So we'll do that, and thank you. Appreciate all you do.
Thanks.
Yeah.